Thanks for listening to WRIF Online. The live web stream will begin in 15 seconds.
Dr. David Bradley will give you that perfect white smile that'll turn heads in less than 2 weeks. No needless discomfort or awkward braces, and you can throw away the trays forever. Check out this painless procedure on Trudy's page or visit BradleyDental.com.
The song is Pages. Find it this Tuesday in stores on the new self-titled Three Doors Down CD. I'm Lou Brutus. The last hour or so, we've been talking to Matt and Brad, Todd, Greg, and Chris of Three Doors Down. Appreciate y'all coming in. It's great to see you again.
Thanks for having us, man.
And again, I know you're going to be on the road and everything for a lot the next year or two, but please give our best to everybody down there on the Gulf Coast especially.
Sure will, man. Thank you.
You have been listening to the world premiere of Three Doors Down. I'm Lou Brutus. We thank you so much for joining us on the Three Doors Down Radio Network.
Welcome to the award-winning Night Call, the Riff's phone-in talk show on 101 WRIF Detroit. Our number, 313-298-WRIF. Now, here's the host of Night Call, Peter Werby.
Well, thank you very much. Welcome to the broadcast. I'm here all by myself tonight. Jalene Jordan has the night off, and so we probably won't be laughing as much. At least I won't. She gets me laughing, doesn't she? But night off tonight, so it's you and me. 313-298-WRIF. If for some reason or other you just tuned by and aren't aware of Night Call, which has been on the air since about 1970. Wow. A WRIF tradition. We're a talk show, and I give my opinions. Very, very strong about my beliefs, as I'm sure you are. And so we invite you to either call in, bring up a subject, disagree with me, agree with me, add to it, strengthen it, whatever. That's what we're here for. That's why WRIF has put Night Call together for almost, what does it make it? Almost 40 years. Wow, that's scary, isn't it? 313-298-9743. And for the shy, and the bashful, I usually say, don't I? For the bashful, and for when the lines are filled, calltalkyes@yahoo.com, which is an email address, obviously. calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Short messages, please. And, I just had this whole list of subjects. Remember, this whole Bush has just come back from the Middle East. Man, what a disaster. And all this talk about appeasement he was trying to lay on Barack Obama. The issue about gay marriage. Obama and racism. I want to talk about that. Gas prices, drugs, capital punishment. That sounds, I don't know, like what? Like a talk show. That's what talk show hosts talk about. But they usually just talk about one of them. But we've got a lot to talk about. Hey, by the way, when you call 313-298-WRIF, usually you get our fine fellow Al. Courtney is going to be at the helm tonight, although Al is in there with her as well. So when you call, welcome Courtney to Night Call. And Jalene Jordan will be back next week. All right, where to start? It's almost hard to do. Now, I don't know if you've caught all this or followed all this, but Bush was over in Israel, and suddenly he starts coming up with this stuff, very unusual, unheard of, unprecedented for an American president to criticize another American politician while in a foreign country. And he suggested that a pledge by the party's presidential frontrunner, Barack Obama, that he would meet with Iran's leader was akin to appeasement of Nazi Germany. And they were made, Bush's comments were made in Jerusalem to the Israeli parliament during celebrations for Israel's 60th anniversary. And Obama accused Bush of engaging in the politics of fear. Well, do you think? I mean, that's all he's done since 9/11. And here's what, in part, what Bush says. He talked about the foolish delusion to the prelude to World War II. So he's going way back. He says he obviously is reading this, right? I mean, he has no idea about history or anything like that. He says, as Nazi tanks crossed into Poland in 1939, an American senator declared, "Lord, if only I could have talked to Hitler, all of this might have been avoided. We have an obligation to call this what it is, the false comfort of appeasement, which has been repeatedly discredited by history." The United States, of course, entered the war almost 2 years after the German invasion of Poland when Japan attacked Pearl Harbor in Hawaii in 1941, at the end of 1941, December 7th. Now, this is, there's so much confusion here, and which is the stock in trade of particularly Bush, particularly of neoconservatives, but of conservatives in general. And it's the old deal about it takes a minute to tie a knot and 60 minutes to untie it. And so I don't want to go through the whole history of World War II and what appeasement meant and British politics and European politics, the rise of Nazism and all that. But maybe a few words are worth making. Now, World War II is on the horizon. Almost everybody knows that it's coming. I mean, Hitler is making aggressive noises, making aggressive demands. And, well, let's get a different context and remember who conservatives are in this. We have a conservative president, a far right-wing president, who, in my estimation, stole the election in 2000 and stole it in 2004. Still, he sits in the office of president. And I've said before in other broadcasts, conservatives in this country have always, remember what their name means. Their name means that they want to conserve things as they are. So conservatives opposed the American Revolution, right? It was wild-eyed radicals and revolutionaries that wanted to break away from the mother country, from England. The conservatives wanted to remain English, to have the U.S. remain colonies. They forced in this country to have slavery embedded in the U.S. Constitution. They made sure that the franchise, the vote, was limited to white propertied males only. And then conservatives fought against the elimination of slavery. They fought against the women's vote. They fought against, you name it. They fought against unions. They fought for every war and against every group that wanted social justice or peace throughout American history. They're against almost everything, and they've been on the wrong side of every social question since this country began. And they also have an ignominious history in Europe as well, in other parts of the world. But let's just stick with kind of our bailiwick, since a good portion of the people here are Euro-Americans, although, you know, not to diminish anyone else from any other part of the world or ancestry or ethnicity or anything like that. But the dominant culture still is pretty much Anglo-American culture, with a lot of most of the folks coming from Europe that inhabit this part of the world. So there was this big, you know, beginning in the 1930s, actually beginning in the 1920s, there was a big contest in Europe about the nature of political rule. And fascism, the idea that you would have this strong leader, no democratic practices, blaming minorities for the problems of the country, suppression of the working class, and wars abroad for the glory of the nation state managed to install itself in any number of countries, Spain, Portugal, Germany, Italy, probably forgetting a couple as well. And it was in every case, the conservative parties backed the fascists. They backed the Nazis. They backed the Falange in Spain. They backed the Black Shirts, Mussolini's group in Italy, and on and on. They always backed the fascists. And when the fascists rose to power, the fascists eliminated everyone to the left of them. The conservatives were a tiny bit to the left of them, but everyone left of center. Liberals and communists and socialists and trade unionists, and then, of course, in the more extreme and radical sense of it, to quote, purify the nation, minorities, Jews and gypsies, Slavs, people like that in Germany. So we have Hitler on the rise, and we have a prime minister of England, Neville Chamberlain. And Neville Chamberlain did, in fact, appease Hitler. He appeased Hitler by allowing Hitler to take over part of Czechoslovakia without a fight. And he was from what party? He was from the Conservative Party. And many, many English in the Conservative Party were sympathetic to the Nazis, which is another long story. But here in this country, politics in many ways was dominated by, certainly there was the Roosevelt liberal New Deal establishment, but there was also this feeling of what they called isolationism at the time, is that the United States was safely ensconced between the two oceans and that we didn't want to get involved in the problems of Europe. So when he quotes, he being Bush in this case, he says, as Nazi tanks crossed into Poland in 1939, an American senator declared, "Lord, if only I could have talked to Hitler, all of this might have been avoided." Now, this was a conservative Republican senator, Senator Borah from Idaho. And most of the Republicans opposed any sort of entrance into the war. They did not. I mean, the American. I'm not trying to say that the American people or the liberals and the Democrats were all gung-ho to get into the war, but most of it was led by the Republicans. So it's the idea, for instance, that that Bush would bring up this whole thing about Nazism and World War II and appeasement is extraordinarily bizarre, and probably the most bizarre element of it and why he would open this can of worms. Although, I'll tell you the truth, I'm very pleased that he did, because Bush's grandfather helped Hitler rise to power. I just stopped there for a second, let that one sink in a bit. Prescott Bush, who was a U.S. senator, and the grandfather of George W. Bush, helped Hitler's rise to power. Oh, that's just a smear you're bringing up. Well, let me just read a paragraph or two from the London Guardian. This is dated September 25, 2004. George Bush's grandfather, the late U.S. Senator Prescott Bush, was a director and shareholder of companies that profited from their involvement with the financial backers of Nazi Germany. The Guardian has obtained confirmation from newly discovered files in the U.S. National Archives that a firm of which Prescott Bush was a director was involved with the financial architects of Nazism. His business dealings, which continued until his company assets were seized in 1942 under the Trading with the Enemy Act. Is that, I mean, if you never heard this before, think about this. Here is a United States senator whose company were finally had their assets seized under the Trading with the Enemy Act, and it led them to more than 60 years to a civil action for damages being brought in Germany against the Bush family by two former slave laborers at Auschwitz, and to a hum of pre-election controversy, which this was 2004. The evidence has also prompted one former U.S. Nazi war crimes prosecutor to argue that the late senator's action should have been grounds for prosecution for giving aid and comfort to the enemy. Now, if you want to see all this, you can go to my website and you can judge for yourself. This is like a 9-page article. I just read 3 paragraphs from it. Peter Werbe, that's my name, W-E-R-B-E, peterwerbe.com, and that this has this article there. So, you know, there's the idea, and whoever, I mean, you know, maybe Bush didn't even know this, because he's not very interested in subjects like this. Well, Bush was also interviewed on Tuesday, and he warned that the Democratic presidential candidates, both of them, plans to withdraw abruptly from Iraq could eventually lead to another attack on the United States and would, quote, embolden terrorists. Now, I don't think that either Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton have a plan to withdraw abruptly. They're talking about over a year. In fact, what is the fifth? You know, like a year and a half. And think about how much money. Well, I don't want to start with the money. How many American lives are going to be lost in a year and a half? How many more civilians are going to die at the hands of U.S. military actions and you know, their puppets in Baghdad? How much we're going to spend of our tax dollars on this? But so this is a concern, though. Yeah, we took a bad hit on September 11, 2001, thanks to George Bush's inattentiveness to the warnings that were all there. But he says that his doomsday scenario, as it says here, for premature withdrawal, quote, of course, is that extremists throughout the Middle East would be emboldened, which would eventually lead to another attack on the United States. The United States pulling out of Iraq or pulling out of the Middle East or not maintaining a forward presence would send all kinds of signals throughout the Middle East. And it would shake everyone's nerves and it would embolden the very same people that we're trying to defeat. Which, I mean, there's so much nonsense embedded in here, it's hard to really extract it all. But is there any truth to what he said? Well, I'll tell you. If the United States suddenly said, look, we're putting our tail between our legs and we're bugging out. You know, you've won. You've defeated us. We got to get out of here. I don't know who it would embolden or what would happen. It's not like these jihadists are going to take over the country of Iraq. But it's going to be, as it almost is now, and oddly enough, a satellite of Iran, which, you know, the Shiite governments in both both countries, and Iran dominating the area. But there's another way to do it, and that's to say, look, we had an awful administration that invaded your country, or to other could say, that invaded Iraq under the most false pretenses imaginable, and that we're sorry that this occurred. It was a dreadful mistake. Certainly your country has suffered the worst, but we've suffered as well. We've had grievous loss to our men and women fighting there. You've certainly had, in terms of dead and wounded and refugees, up into the millions. And we want to leave and we want to make this okay. We want to establish relationship with your country and we want to make up to what the damage we've done. We have to take care of the damage we've done to our country and the damage that we've done to the men and women that have suffered so badly because of Bush's illegal and unnecessary war as well. But I'm talking about what's going to happen. So suddenly you're saying, wait a minute, the guys running things before totally screwed everything up, created this horrible situation where who knows how many people have died, because it's, you know, it's hard to count the Iraqis. We know exactly how many of our soldiers have died. You know, we're talking 4,077, 60,000 wounded, 300,000 suffering a variety of post-traumatic stress disorder. How many head injuries are? I can't even keep track of it all. It's just been this horrible disaster. Bush warns of Iraq disaster. Bush created the Iraq disaster. And it's going to take some real doing to get out. Well, we have, at least things are getting a little better with Grumpy Grandpa McShane. John McCain says that the war can be won. He's still on that. By 2013, he wants us in there for another 5 years. And again, how many more young men and women are going to die from the United States? How many more hundreds of billions of dollars are we going to spend? How many more millions of Iraqis are going to suffer because of this all? But remember, he said he wouldn't have any problem with the United States having troops there for 100 years, so he's down to 5, although he would say we'd still keep a little bit of a contingent. So that's, also in Afghanistan, the Pentagon is moving forward with plans to build a new 40-acre detention complex on the main American military base in Afghanistan. Until now, the Bush administration had signaled that it intended to scale back American involvement in detention operations in Afghanistan. It had planned to transfer a large majority of prisoners to Afghan custody in the American-financed high-security prison outside Kabul to be guarded by Afghan soldiers. They now said they it can't absorb all the Afghans, and they don't trust the Afghan guards. Conditions are so terrible in what is currently there that this is supposed to be an improvement. But we're, again, talking about long-term involvement in fighting these elusive guerrilla fighters. Now, what in the world are we doing there? Why are we fighting who we call the Taliban? I mean, whoever fights the United States is the Taliban. There's a Taliban. I mean, the Taliban was okay with George Bush before 9/11. You may or may not remember that that Bush sent $42 million of our tax dollars over to the Taliban government in April of 2001 to congratulate them for eradicating poppy production growth there, the basis of heroin. So they had wiped it out because, you know, they're very conservative. They're like Bush. You know, you get all these folks are conservative, right? Everybody in Iraq is conservative. Bush is conservative. The Taliban is conservative. What's going on now is sort of a world war among conservatives. That's what it really is, a world war between conservatives. I mean, fortunately, it's not on the scale that the first two were. But we've got to somehow chill all these people out because they're dangerous to all of us, as we've seen on in every regard. But after September 11th, the fact that the Afghan government was allowing Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden, or what do we say, Osama bin Forgotten, to have base there, it was a punitive expedition to destroy the base, hopefully to capture the men responsible for perpetrating this horrible crime in the United States, would have been legitimate. Why the United States is now involved in this anti-guerrilla war, and you know how these go on forever and ever and ever. Well, terrible. Money for it all. Linda Bilmes, who is a former Assistant Secretary and Chief Financial Officer of the U.S. Department of Commerce, she's now a professor at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. She co-authored the book, The $3 Trillion War. And this is just current figures. If they start, the war goes on for another 5 years. She says, there's no such thing as a free lunch, and there's no such thing as a free war. After 5 years of war, 4,000 U.S. deaths, 60,000 injuries, $600 billion spent so far, with the price tag expected to reach $3 trillion once we add veterans' costs, military reset, interest on the debt, and economic losses, the U.S. public is waking up to the fact that the war is hurting the economy. At least I hope we are. Got to get soldiers, though, and you would think that nobody would be joining. Turned out that the Marines have met 142% of recruitment goals for April. Got about 2,500 soldiers or recruits for the Marines, and the other branches of service got theirs as well. But there's an interesting article from the Interpress Service. School military recruiting could violate international protocol. Pressed by the demands of the global war on terrorism, the United States is violating an international protocol that forbids the recruitment of children under the age of 18 for military service. They charge that the recruitment practices target children as young as 11 years old. Where, there are this whole thing about child soldiers, all in Africa particularly. Well, they're saying the same thing is happening here. Soldiers of Misfortune is the 46-page report. It's put out by the ACLU for submission to the United Nations Committee on the Rights of the Child. Also found that the U.S. military disproportionately targets poor and minority public school students. Military recruiters, according to the report, use exaggerated promises of financial rewards for enlistment, which undermines the voluntariness of the enlistment. Some cases documented by the report, recruiters use coercion, deception, even sexual abuse in order to gain recruits. Perpetrators of such practices are only very rarely punished. Let's see here. The pressure, among the provisions of this protocol, sets an absolute minimum age for recruitment of 16 and requires that all recruitment activities directed at children under 18 be carried out with the consent of the child's parent or guardian. So this was all come to in Bush's America, and how quickly can we leave this? And I don't mean just handily defeating Grumpy Grandpa McSame, but how can we reverse this assault on everything that Bush has so dramatically changed and ruined? Well, you tell me. I'm Peter Werbe, Jeline Jordan off for the night, 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Let's get some calls in before our break, though. We'll do that. Here is St. Michael in Birmingham. Hey, Saint, you're on the air.
This is St. Michael the Archangel, Peter.
Good. I see. Wait a minute. I know where you are. You have a little platform on a building on Woodward up in Birmingham there, don't you?
No, I don't know. Anyways, I just have one thing to say, and that's that, as far as I'm concerned, Barack Obama is the Prince of Darkness.
How come? Boy. This is a... Was that either supposed to be funny or just stupid? It wasn't funny, and it was stupid. But that could lead me into my next subject. Let me do this. Okay. How stupid are some white people? Very stupid, I think. This situation in West Virginia. You know why there's a West Virginia? Because West Virginia did not want to go into the Confederacy, did not want to be a slave state. And you had so many people voting in West Virginia on the basis of race. Race! Race! This is the 21st century. This isn't 1952. No, it's 2008. I just can't even believe that there are morons of the extent that are quoted in some of these articles. Of why they voted. Here, this from the Financial Times, May 11th. Like most people in Mingo County, West Virginia, Leonard Simpson is a lifelong Democrat, but given a choice between Barack Obama and John McCain in November, the 67-year-old retired coal miner would vote Republican. Now, here is a retired coal miner. He was a member of the United Mine Workers, obviously, everybody in West Virginia. I don't know if they still are. Certainly when he was active, they would have been. Bush has turned over mine safety to mining industry lobbyists who have reduced the standards. They have reduced health standards for people in the mines, on and on and on like that. Mr. Simpson, drawing on a cigarette outside the fire station in Williamson, a coal mining town of 3,400 people, I heard that Obama is a Muslim and his wife's an atheist. on one hand, they say, and his Christian minister, has made all these dumb anti-American remarks. So they know about Reverend, what was his first name? I can't remember. Wright. This is Jeremiah Wright. So they know about all that, yet they say he's a Muslim. He's got a Christian minister, but they think he's a Muslim. So you're talking about stupidity here. And if all of a sudden I'm tromping on your toes, dear listener, I'm sorry. But this is a world in which we right now, everyone alive, has to make some critical decisions about the fate of this country and the fate of the planet. And you can't go off with misinformation. I mean, I don't like it when people that are fully informed disagree with me, just, like most, I defend your right to say it and all that, but to base decisions on ridiculous misinformation that no one, everyone knows is nonsense, you're not doing your duty as a human being even. So, there's no conservative, there's no sensible conservative that thinks Barack Obama is a Muslim. That's idiotic. Most people questioned said they mistrusted Mr. Obama because of doubts about his patriotism and, quote, values stemming from his cosmopolitan background. What does that mean? He's from Chicago? They like Grandpa McSame because he's from Arizona? I mean, he's married to a woman who's worth $100 million. He's an elitist. They're all elitists. They're all millionaires. Actually, Barack Obama is by far and away the poorest of the three candidates, to be sure. The contrary surrounding anti-American sermons by Jeremiah Wright. Several people said they believed he was a Muslim, an unfounded rumor that has been circulated on the Internet for months, despite the contradiction with his 20-year membership in Wright's church in Chicago. Others mentioned his refusal to wear a Stars and Stripes badge. He just didn't do it. I would never wear one. I would never wear one because of the kind of idiots that would demand that I would. That somehow that's how one can measure patriotism. This is a right-wing thing. Every right-winger wears a little flag pin on their lapel. I don't mean to say that if you wear a flag pin on your lapel, you're a right-winger, but every right-winger does. Now, let's see. And controversial remarks about Michelle, who described America as mean, implied that she had never been... So, conservative commentators have questioned Obama's patriotism for months. Why? What do you mean patriotism? He supports what? I don't know. China? England? France? This is so you know, you can dislike his policies, but this is idiotic. And here, Whit Ayers, a Republican strategist, said, the American people want a president who loves their country as much as they do. Let's see. Josh Fry, a 24-year-old ambulance driver from Williamson, insisted he was not a racist, but said he would feel more comfortable with McCain, the 71-year-old Vietnam War hero in the White House. He said, I want someone who is a full-blooded American as president. Full-blooded? Huh. I'm not a racist. No, of course not. This guy's a 24-year-old ambulance driver. What do you think he makes an hour? $7? $8? And he's going to vote for a representative of the party of the ultra-rich. Now, I could go on and on about this, but there's an article in the Washington Post from May 13th. Racist incidents give some Obama campaigners pause because they can't imagine that people would object to Barack Obama on the basis of race. They thought, this is all gone. We won this battle. There's not people still so stupid, so blind, so mean-spirited that they would base votes on the pigmentation of someone's skin or the 50% pigmentation of their skin. Barack Obama's mother is of European extraction, what we call white, right? So why isn't he white? Why isn't he, you know, what they always say, mama baby, papa maybe? We know he has a white mother, so doesn't that make him white? Isn't most cultures matrilineal? Don't they trace family and ethnic identity through the mother? Yeah. Now here, documentary filmmaker Rory Kennedy, the daughter of the late Robert F. Kennedy, said she too had come across, quote, a lot of racism when campaigning for Obama in Pennsylvania. One Pittsburgh union organizer told her he would not vote for Obama because he is black. Union. We're talking union here. And a white voter, she said, offered this frank reason for not backing Obama. And this is what it's all about. White people look out for white people, and black people look out for black people. This is what some white voter said. White people look out for white people, and black people look out for black people. Well, what white people are looking out for us that are in power currently? The white people from the all-white party of the Republican Party, the all-white Republican Party, they're looking out for our interests. They got us in a war, right? They're wrecking the environment. They've destroyed the economy. They've got everybody in the world hating us. So are these, quote, white people looking out for us white people? And how about black people looking out for black people? Well, I started thinking about that. And I don't know. Someone said, what would you say to that woman? I'd probably say goodbye. But I went on the Internet and I got the Congressional Black Caucus agenda for the 109th Congress. And Congressional Black Caucus, as you can imagine, is made up of the African-American congressional members. And so it has a number of things in there about discrimination and other things having to do with race. But here's their first, here's their platform. It's not real long. Actually, there's quite a bit to it. But supporting early childhood nutrition, Head Start in the movement towards universal preschool, providing student nutrition, identifying and providing education and assistance appropriate to the needs of each individual student to fulfill the promise of no child left behind, dropout prevention, after-school programs, school modernization and infrastructure and equipment enhancement. Well, boy. These black people are really looking out only for black people, aren't they? Doesn't sound like they could care less about white people. I'm being facetious, of course, because this affects everyone. Let's see. Here's another part of it. Emphasizing universal access, affordable, and prevention in health care. Providing meaningful coverage for prescription medications to every American. You know, see how broad this is? This is the Black Congressional Caucus. They're not talking about medical care for black people, or they're not talking about schools for black. They're talking about, this is an agenda for everyone. Ensuring the employment of a diverse workforce by employers in the private sector, protecting the rights and working conditions of all employees. I didn't say black employees. Protecting the rights and working conditions of all employees. Providing support to enable people to work, such as child care, transportation, health care, job retraining, and a living wage. In terms of justice and crime, advocating for criminal and juvenile justice reform that focuses greater emphasis on prevention and rehabilitation. Preserving Social Security as a safety net for older Americans and guaranteeing that Social Security benefits continue to be paid, making it possible for people of all income levels to accumulate assets and save for retirement. What else? Foreign policy, reaching the millennium goals for developing countries, that's eradicating poverty, hunger, and armed conflict in countries around the world. So let's go back to this poor woman, and I say poor because just how stupid she could be. White people look out for white people. Black people look out for black people. Well, we have the all-white Republican Party, and how are they looking out for us? And then you have the agenda of the Black Congressional, the Congressional Black Caucus, and their agenda looks out for all the rest of us. So she's really got it screwed on backwards, doesn't she? If you're thinking through, if you're looking at the world and thinking about the world through the lens of race, you're really going to be jerked around all the time, because that's what the rulers, the conservative rulers, have always used to get people's mind off of the issues. Did you notice that when I was reading about what these idiots in West Virginia were concerned about, whether Obama was patriotic, whether he was a Muslim, whether his wife was mean and stuff like that. They mentioned the war? No. They mentioned their own pathetic economic situation in West Virginia? No. Did they mention whatsoever that these mining companies that are destroying the West Virginia environment? No. They say, I don't want to vote for a black man. Come on. It's the 21st century. Let's act like it. 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. I'll be right back.
This is WRIF.com. It's your big shot at nabbing a 2008 Harley-Davidson XL1200N Sportster Nightster, courtesy of Motor City Harley-Davidson. A two-year lease on a 2008 Dodge Ram 1500 Quad Cab Laramie 4x4, courtesy of Oakland Dodge. A trip for two to Harley-Davidson's 105th anniversary celebration, Labor Day weekend in Milwaukee, courtesy of Miller Lite. And 500 bucks worth of gas to get you there. Compliment to the rim. Keep it tuned to 101 WRIF to win 50 bucks in free gas, plus a key to these sweet wheels and more. June 14th at Freedom Hill and Sterling Heights. Also, listen for details on Harley Bike Nights around the Motor City, where you can win a key in person. Think you can handle the rush? Harley Fest 2008. Presented by Motor City Harley Davidson. Feel the freedom at the number one dealer in Farmington Hills. Also presented by Miller Lite. Miller Lite. Bigger, bolder, summer. Oakland Dodge. And your Harley Fest 2008 station. 101 WRIF. Every rock. Looking back at me.
Sorry for
WRIF.com. The Rick satisfies your need for speed with racing action that rocks. Memorial Day weekend rocks as 101, WRIF, and Firestone present exclusive IMS Radio Network coverage of the 92nd running of the Indianapolis 500, Sunday, May 25th, starting at noon. In 2008, 101, WRIF is your home for Indianapolis Motor Speedway Network race coverage. From the green all the way to that checkered flag. The granddaddy of them all. The Indianapolis 500, live from the Brickyard. Presented by Firestone. Firestone, presenting sponsor of the Detroit Indy Grand Prix on 101 WRIF. The Riff. WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much and welcome back. Thanks for all your emails. People said I was overmodulating. Maybe it's just, I don't know, getting upset about things. 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. Jalene Jordan off for the evening. And let's get you on the air, though. Here is Ace in Royal Oak. Ace, it's Peter Werby. Thanks for joining me on WRIF.
Peter, good evening. Long-time listener, first-time caller. I'm really excited.
Well, thanks. Thanks for joining.
I was just going to comment that I'm very concerned about the welfare of the United States. I've been overseas for a couple of years in France working on contract there, and I can't believe how disconnected mainstream Americans are from the political climate.
How so?
Did you say how so?
Yeah.
Just on every level, just what's happening in our in the world, in our environment, and more so politically, you know, what's happening in the East. The Russians are plowing into the Arctic. Members of OPEC are trying to unpeg the U.S. dollar to the oil. I mean, so much instability, yet we're just completely drawn by what, you know, what Britney Spears does with her haircut. Or,
well, I was going to say, you really think, Ace, that's all more important than whether Barack Obama wears a flag pin?
No, I don't think it's all that important whether he wears a flag pin or not. I'm just...
Right. I know what you're saying.
I'm really worried that Americans don't know what's happening out there. They lack the foresight, and I don't know. I try and be a model citizen and make people aware of what's going on, and concerns that I have, obviously, for our education system, our healthcare systems in dire straits, and obviously the economy and what's happening with our currency and how it's devalued with other currencies overseas. But I feel like all this falls on deaf ears.
I don't think totally on deaf ears. There's a number, you know, there's great numbers in this country that do keep abreast of things. Partly it is source. So you don't have any opposition media in this country to speak of. I mean, there's, you know, like Air America for talk shows and a little bit on MSNBC on television, but most of it is dominated by corporations. And so you don't, there's not a dialogue like you get in Europe. And so if you want opposing opinions in France, there's any number of publications that you can listen to. But I agree with you. I certainly agree with you. Well, thank you, Ace. Thanks for joining us. Welcome back home. 313-298-WRIF. Here's Andrew in St. Clair Shores. Hi, Andrew. You're on the air.
Hey, I'm just a little concerned about the gas prices.
Yeah?
You know, last year, $3 was pretty much a shock. But now it's like diesel, I saw it $4.60-something.
I know. I wonder who's going to be the – I wonder if anybody in Michigan has paid over $4 yet. I've seen it up at around 390, but and I just heard in Connecticut and in Alaska it's hit over $4. But you know what, Andrew? What they want to see is how much will we take? And we seem to be, you know, we grumble, right? And we haven't found a way to express the concern we have, how badly this is hurting so many of us. And actually, in one level, except for unless you got jillions and jillions of dollars, hurts everybody, even if you're middle class. I mean, filling up, it used to be $20, now it's $60. Whoa! That's a bite, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, it is. All right. Thank you for bringing it up. I want to actually mention something about that. There's an article in the New York Times, May 17th. What is today? 18th? Yeah, so it was yesterday. In Riyadh, President Bush used a private visit to King Abdullah's ranch here on Friday to make another appeal for an increase in oil production that might give American consumers some relief at the gas pump. Please, would you please pump a little more gas for us, a little more oil? The Saudis responded by announcing they had decided a week ago on a modest increase of 300,000 barrels a day. So this would not be enough to lower oil prices. So here you have the pathetic spectacle of the man who is the most powerful person in the world going with hat in hand, begging essentially, I mean, I don't know, I was going to say a client state. Maybe we've become the client state, right? Because we give these guys billions and billions of dollars, ostensibly fought the Gulf War in 1991 to protect them. I mean, that's just a big lie, but that was what it's all about. And, I mean, there is a good and somewhat supportable conspiracy theory that this is just another tax. So you and I pay more and more at the gas pump, and this goes to the people that control the wellheads that pump the oil. So they get billions and billions of excess profits. I'm talking about the countries that pump it, like Saudi Arabia. And then they loan the United States money in order to continue to operate because Bush has rammed us into debt over the last 7 or 8 years. Bush said Saudi Arabia's small increase in oil production will not solve soaring U.S. oil prices. Well, gee, thanks. As oil prices hit another record high on Friday, Saudi King Abdullah rebuffed Bush's request for higher oil production to take the pressure off of prices. The high prices are a political nightmare in a presidential election year for Bush and his would-be Republican successor, John McCain. Where is this from? This is from MyWay.com. Bush said he cautioned the king about the repercussions of skyrocketing prices. I said very plainly, I said, you got to be concerned about the effects of high oil prices on some of the biggest customers in the world. And not only that, of course, high energy prices are going to cause countries like mine to accelerate our move toward alternative energy. I mean, what? Does he expect anybody to believe that guff? Can you imagine these guys sitting around and he's, we're going to move to alternative energy? All his buddies, all of Bush's buddies are either rulers of oil countries or the oil companies in the United States. He's buddies with ExxonMobil. They contribute hundreds of thousands of dollars. Bush said it's something, the 300,000 barrels a day more, but it doesn't solve our problem. Our problem in America gets solved when we aggressively go for domestic exploration. What is he talking about? We are way beyond peak oil. You know what he's talking about. He wants to let his buddies in the oil companies drill for oil up in Alaska in these environmentally sensitive areas. If we began that today, you may have seen this or heard this. We haven't talked about this in a long time. In this ANWR, what is it? Arctic National, I can't remember what it is. I mean, this has been going around for so long. It would take 10 years to get this online. And as it is, they talk about they would export most of the oil. Our problem in America is solved by expanding our refining capacity. Promote nuclear energy. More of his buddies, more insane policies from the 20th century that didn't work. Rather than criticize the Saudis, you know, they're his friends. They're his father's friends. Bush turned his fire on Democrats back home, threatening to kill a $1.4 billion arms sale to Saudi Arabia unless it pumps at least 1 million additional barrels a day. We're going to sell people that are in the midst of this volatile area $1.4 billion more of armaments? This is totally insane. And also this from Haaretz, which is a English language paper in Israel. Bush offers Saudis nuclear power. That's a good idea. In exchange for more oil. Bush, visiting the Saudi capital on Friday, hoped to formalize new agreements that would give the relationship between the new countries a boost. Among them was an agreement for the U.S. to assist the kingdom in developing civilian nuclear power. Isn't that what Iran says it's doing? Developing civilian nuclear power? Another agreement involves U.S. promises to help protect any Saudi nuclear infrastructure with training, the exchange of experts, and other support services as needed. What if we get a government, what if the sort of Bush types gets a government in Saudi Arabia that doesn't like the United States and that has nuclear capacity and has the capacity to transform that into weapons-grade fuel? Or, I don't know. How could the worst and the stupidest and the most dangerous people in the world wind up to control our fates? It is so far. Maybe, you know, it's us. We have got to stop this. 313-298-WRIF. Here's Frank in Dearborn. Frank, hi. It's Peter Werby. Hey, Frank. I'm sorry. I got to press this little button. Sorry, Frank. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes.
Hi.
This first time listener, man. I think I'm enjoying your show here.
Well, thank you. Do you have more?
Hello.
Hello, Frank. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Over here.
You know, Frank, you're going to have to just keep listening to it because you're having problems there. But thank you. I hope that didn't turn you off. Here's Anthony in Clinton Township. Anthony, hi. You're on the air.
Hey, what's up, man?
How you doing?
Good. How about yourself?
Good.
I had a comment about, you were talking about Barack Obama and emails that you were reading. And, you know, it's funny because somebody said that they want a full-blooded American.
Yeah.
And the point is, unless you're an Indian, you're not a full-blooded American.
There you go.
You know, and I don't care who runs the country, if it's a black guy, if it's a female, if it's a white guy, it's got to be somebody who cares about America that does good. And personally, I wouldn't vote for any of these guys because I don't trust none of them. I think it's all about the money.
Well, it is. Unfortunately.
Yeah, and you were talking about the oil and stuff. It's all tactic. They all, you know, it's all planned out. They know exactly what they're doing. It's nothing's by mistake, and it's for the money. And that's what's going to run this country down is people chasing that doubt.
I think so. And until we get some policies, I mean, I agree with you completely. Unless we get policies, and that's what is important. Again, not gender, not race, not ethnic origin. Well, I guess you could. Yeah, right. Ethnic origin. It's all just going to keep going to hell. All right, I got to take a break. Thank you for joining us and for that as well. I'll be right back. 313-298-WRIF. Emails at calltalkyes@yahoo.com.
This is WRIF.com. Great live rock, awesome bikes, cold beer, hot babes. And for the 10th anniversary, we've taken it up another notch. 101 WRIF, Miller Lite, and Oakland Dodge present the 10th annual Motor City Harley-Davidson Harley Fest. Saturday, June 19th at Freedom Hill in Sterling Heights, featuring live rock all day long, including Days of the New, Bob Evil, plus the Howling Diablos, Ashes of Soma, and many more. Plenty of vendors, food, the best in bike show, and tons of free stuff to do all day long.
Doug. You'll get all the details you need right now at WRAF.com. Saturday, June 14th at Freedom Hill in Sterling Heights. The 10th annual Motor City Harley-Davidson's Harley Fest. Feel the freedom at the number one dealer in Farmington Hills. Also presented by Miller Lite. Miller Lite. Bigger. Bolder. Summer. Oakland Dodge. And your Harley Fest 2008 station. 101 WRAF. Every WRIF.com. Friday, May 16th, the finals of the 2008 Riff Rock Girl Search, featuring the return of Future. With special guest, Red. Vote for your favorite now at WRIF.com. There, see the final four. Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much, Jalene Jordan, off for the evening. 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. I've been reading some of your email at calltalkyes@yahoo.com. We're talking about gas prices in part, and where is this up here? Oh, yeah. TJ writes into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Caller just mentioned gas prices, and you asked if anywhere in Michigan had seen $4. I would think so, seeing that on my way home from Kalamazoo yesterday, driving 94 East, I saw regular for $3.98. He says, I'm sure someone has hit the $4 mark in that area up if it's up that high. With my car, I have to put in premium. So I've been paying over $4 for almost 2 weeks. I paid $4.15 yesterday. You really got to, I don't want to start a big technical thing, but I don't know. I can't, unless you got, I don't know. Can't you use regular and everything? I thought that most of that premium stuff is just, you know, kind of a hype. Whatever. Don't call me about it. Email me at calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Do some cars or trucks actually need premium? Well, TJ, you can write me back. Roderick writes in that he paid 3.999. So it's almost there, folks. It's almost upon us. Another one of those milestones, right? So let's see. What do we got coming up? Your calls, of course, at 313-298-WRIF at 1 a.m. Eastern Time. Actually, everyone listening now is on Eastern Time because apparently our stream is not working this evening. I have no idea why, no way to check, or no way to make it happen. But we are the podcasts now are going to be, and I'm going to knock on, actually, this isn't plastic, some sort of, actually, I think it is. But they're going to be up on Monday, so you can check WRIF.com. And we'll hook you up in case you've missed the show or part of it. Now, if you want to see Bill O'Reilly melt down, you can go to my website, Peter Werby, W-E-R-B-E, Peter Werby, W-E-R-B-E dot com, and go down a few items. And it's absolutely incredible when he just freaks out. And then they've got the, you know, they kind of hooked it into a parody. Also, all that information we're talking about in the first hour, how Bush's grandfather, Prescott Bush, helped the German dictator rise to power, Hitler, that is. So we're talking about appeasing? You know, Bush's family was right in there. He got a lot of help from American corporations as well, including Henry Ford, who was a big fan of Hitler, and Hitler was a big fan of... I mean, my headphones are up way too high. There you go. Also, that whole thing about appeasement that Bush was trying to run... there was this right-wing moron talk show host that Chris Matthew just ate up on MSNBC. You can go to my website as well and get that. At 1 a.m., Mark Bauerlein, oh, you know, I should have brought this up a long time ago. In many ways, I should have played this at the beginning of the show because aren't we all almost wired into the Internet and all of its sort of electronic communication, texting, and cell phones and what have you. Mark Bauerlein has written a book called The Dumbest Generation, How the Digital Age Stupefies Young Americans and Jeopardizes Our Future. So it's a shot across the bow of young people who are always connected. I don't even have a cell phone, so I can't text. I communicate enough. I got enough information. I'm in touch with enough people more than I need to, even. After that, Tom Hartman, the Air America talk show host, my buddy. Walking Your Blues Away, How to Heal the Mind and Create Emotional Well-Being. This has some, you know, Tom, although probably one of the most knowledgeable political guys in the country, has got a lot of different hats, and I thought this was an interesting interview. And I think he probably does tie it up with some political concepts, or at least how we look at the world politically. All right, 313-298-WRIF. Here's Ryan in Bloomfield. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello, Peter.
Hi.
First time caller, long time listener. Very glad to be here.
Well, thank you. I'm glad you're here.
Leading off, I thought it was a very clever turn of phrase you had, the worst and the stupidest. You know, if David Halberstam were still with us, he could make that his sequel to The Best and the Brightest.
There you go.
I wanted to touch on the issue you brought up about Obama and people criticizing him for patriotism. The patent absurdity of this, we are suffering from what I call eyes-off-the-ball politics. We're being distracted by irrelevant issues and shiny objects. Consider the instances people are talking about. He didn't wear a flag pin. He didn't put his hand over his heart when he said the Pledge of Allegiance. These are not pertinent insights. They're mindless rituals people are criticizing him for not partaking in.
Sure.
What does he have to do? Does he have to show up behind the podium wearing a Captain America outfit to please these people?
Yeah, I guess.
It is possible, entirely possible, to love your country without blindly worshiping it.
I know. Who was the English? All of a sudden, I'm forgetting his name. Said patriotism is the last refuge of a scoundrel,
and the first resort of a politician. I believe it was Oscar Wilde, but I'm not exactly sure.
I think it goes back to the 18th century.
My favorite was Bill Hicks. He said, "You know, the best way to get rid of this boot rally mentality is to replace the flag with pictures of our parents screwing. See if people can start saluting that." I've forgotten. Damn it, I'm out of here. I've had enough of this.
You are. All right. Thank you very much. Yeah, an incredibly funny comedian who died way too early, unfortunately. Here's Maurice in Detroit. I think he has a conspiracy theory. Maurice, hi, you're on the air.
How you doing, Peter? Only thing I'm saying, look how the economy was before the war. 5-6 years after the war, look at the economy. Now, if we can go to 2013, I believe this country will be bankrupt.
Well, I don't know. Could be.
And I tell you, price of gas, I got a friend that drives a cab. He said when he reached 450, he'll have to find another job. He had to put gas in his car to go to work and put gas in the cab when he get to work.
Yeah.
And it's killing him.
I know. Think about people that depend on fuel. And how it affects all these prices. How it's not only do we have to pay more, but and prices rise. But well, the prices rise is the inflation. So we're getting looted. But of course, some people are making out just fine. That's who all the money is going to. All right, thank you, Maurice. I think we've got to get that under control. Here's Steve and Troy. Steve, thanks for calling 313-298-WRI. If you're on the air,
how are you?
Good.
This big thing for me is the gas price, I think, is a great subject for you guys to bring up on.
Uh-huh.
I do own 2 full-size vehicles, and this is killing me as an independent and small business contractor. This is hurting us in every way. I feel that they came out with a solution on ethanol, but yet it's costing us more on milk, you know, for for our children. And also for our meat, our dairy, all our transportation and that. And it's making it hard for me being, you know, 30 years old and having 2 small children. There's nothing we can do about it. You know, it's affected us every way. It's going to make us like a high class and a poor class at this point.
Well, it's on its way to doing that. That's for sure.
Being an independent contractor with the prices of copper wire and everything else going up, it's affecting anybody wanting to spend any money to do anything to their homes or commercial buildings and thereon. You know, so it's a bad thing all the way around, and nobody's putting their foot down. And I mean, I think it's a great subject that you guys are bringing up tonight, and I wish actually somebody would do something about this, especially the government. And putting their foot down, and now they're saying the competition of gas is getting, you know, there's not enough competition out there no more. So now they got a reason to spike everything up for us.
Sure. Well, this is not looked upon as a crisis. This is, the only reason that politicians seem to be paying any attention to it whatsoever is because people are starting to get angry. But how does our anger manifest itself politically? We see what happens in other countries. They have big, huge strikes. In some countries, they've had riots and what have you. But we don't seem to be able to find a manner or, in a sense, an agency. I don't mean like a government agency, but something through which to make our protests, our outrage at being looted like this manifest. I mean, how do we do it? I don't know.
Well, like what you guys are doing tonight, it needs to be more outspoken like this.
Sure.
Because obviously we're a one-state depression right now. and it's affecting everybody. The foreclosure rate's out, you know, outstanding right now, and all they're doing is adding to the problem for people. And we need to, you know, have more of a vocal focus here and, you know, have it where everybody's going to, you know, stand up and do something about it. I mean, $4 a gallon is killing everybody. There's no better way to put it here.
Well, I think that is the way to put it. And I just wonder whether this can keep going like this without, I mean, there's got to be a breaking point. That's all. Well, thank you, Steve. Yeah, go ahead.
I've heard that they're talking that it's going to keep rising and rising and rising. And, you know, I mean, this is a thing that the government needs to step in and put their foot down on this situation.
Yeah, I agree. All right, Steve, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Valerie in Waterford wants to talk about gas prices as well. Hi, Valerie. It's Peter. You're on the air.
Hi, Peter. It's really nice to talk to you.
Well, thank you.
I just also first wanted to say thank you for all the insights you have into so many topics and the resources you made me realize I have had available to me for do the my own research.
Good.
So thank you.
Well, good.
sorry, but anyways, on the corner of M15 and Dixie Highway in Clarkston, it was 409 on Friday.
Wow.
Yes, and I'm a waitress, and I worked all weekend, and I mean, I see it every day. I mean, I'm not getting 10% like at all. Like, people are, like, it's so slow, no one's coming in because they can't afford the extra money with the gas prices. It's awful. We're all being affected by it.
Well, you know, I wonder about that. I go to some places, and I think, wow, is anything really going wrong? You go to some restaurants, they're jammed to the rafters, and yet I hear the same thing, you know, Valerie, you're saying from other people, that business is way down. You know?
Yes, it's awful.
Yeah.
And then the fact that the only way they're being able to sell cars right now is by giving these gas incentives.
Yeah, I love
with
that.
Free gas. That's all I hear see on TV is car commercials with free gas.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I sort of stumble for an answer because I'm not sure what the answer is here. We know the problem. And we know that when I use the kind of the loaded phrase that we're being looted is that because our wealth is being taken from us and it winds up in the hands of other people. It's not like everyone suffers across the board. It's not like the big oil companies suffer and the oil, you know, the crude oil producers suffer and the refiners and the dealers and us. We're getting screwed, and the money that we could be using for lots of other stuff is going to going up to the high side.
Yeah.
So that's why it is, and that's what I mean. It's key to these gas prices. Not like bad weather. You can't do anything about the weather, but
mm-hmm.
but this is a political question, and right now, like I was saying to our last caller, we don't have the way. As I often say this, is if someone said, okay, let's, Valerie, you and me, and my memory's so bad I forgot the name of the last caller. If the three of us said, all right, let's tomorrow, we're going to be active around gas prices, I wouldn't know what to do, right?
Yeah.
I can define the problem. You can define the problem. You see the results. You're experiencing the results in your daily life just like I do. But
uh-huh.
But what's got to be developed is something that addresses it. And there's two ways. One is politically, getting political leadership that does something in terms of statutes or policy. And the other thing is mass movements, the way you have in other countries, or the way we've operated in this country where the people have made history. And that's not happening yet. Neither of them are happening. Well, I'll think about it. Thank you, Valerie.
No, thank you.
All right. Bye-bye now. Appreciate your call. Somebody talked to me. Who was I talking to? They'd live somewhere else. So who could that have been? I can't put my finger. A friend of mine. And they were saying, is it still all guys that call your show? I said, well, mainly, I guess. But, I don't know what I can say about that. Except everybody's welcome to call. Here's Lars in Madison Heights. Lars, thanks for calling.
Hi, Peter. A couple of days ago, I had a run-in with a schizophrenic third.
A schizophrenic what?
You know, last week I called to tell you about the about one-third of the population seems to either be schizophrenic or retarded.
Oh, you said you were with the schizophrenic third.
Yeah, I had a run-in with.
Okay.
Are you familiar with Senator Jim Webb's improved Montgomery GI Bill?
I am to some extent, but I bet you probably know, being a member of the Iraq Veterans Against the War and being an Iraq veteran, I suspect you probably know it better than I do. So tell me.
Well, basically, it went for a vote in the House of Representatives, and despite being very popular among veterans, the presidential candidate Ron Paul voted against it. I went to a conservative message board and pointed it out, and not only were people, I was surprised, not only were people siding with him, they were demonizing me for expecting more more money for better benefits and more money for college.
Yeah, screw the veterans, right?
Yeah, this is the thing. I assumed it was all middle-aged chicken hawks who at the very least might have, you know, been in the Army in like 83 and maybe almost went to Grenada. But one of the people who was steadfast against it claimed that they were an active duty officer in the United States military. We won't go into details except that he was leaving for, he had been to Iraq twice. And people were siding with him. There's only like maybe one other member of the message board who thought that the current GI Bill is inadequate.
Yeah.
And that just shocked me because I straight up called him an Uncle Tom.
Probably a better word, but I don't know what it is. Yeah, why? I mean, doesn't the U.S. government, when it sends people off to war, have this absolute duty to provide the best and most extensive aftercare, if you will, for the rest of the lives of people that have been so used in this? Well, even if the policy was a good one, still, I mean, it doesn't matter what the nature of it is. You send people off to war, you have the richest country in the world, and we know the problems with the Veterans Administration, that in terms of getting proper care, in terms of dealing with people and the enormous problems that men and women are coming home from Iraq and Afghanistan with, and you got Ron Paul is against it. Grumpy Grandpa McSame is against the bill as well.
Well, that's what I heard so far. He has his own version, but this is the thing that I thought was hilarious, is that people affiliated with the Pentagon are against it because they think, quote, it will hurt retention, meaning people won't be forced to reenlist just because they can't conceive of making a living outside of the military.
Yeah, that was absolutely extraordinary, that the Pentagon thinks if you offer GIs too many post-service benefits that they won't re-up, that they'll go, hey, maybe I'll go to college instead of being cannon fodder for these unnecessary wars. Yeah. All right. Well, thanks for bringing that up, Lars. I appreciate it. Thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. Here's Ed. Ed's in South Lyon. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Morning, Peter.
Hi.
Money and power makes the world go round, doesn't it?
Sure.
I'd like to touch on a comment you said earlier. When you said the government is in debt,
yeah.
Who are they in debt to? If they're the ones that coin the money, can't they just pay that machine up quicker?
Well, they could, but then the currency becomes worth less and less. Well, the U.S. debt is held, foreign governments hold about 25% of the total, and you have foreign investors that keep investing in the dollar.
Well, Peter, you know what it is. It's the world bankers.
I get a little edgy when I start hearing that phrase. And
it's the world bankers. You know that.
Well, it's not the world. The world bankers has an unfortunate connotation to it that I don't want to use here. It's world bankers to 99% of the people, fortunately, and they're probably scratching their head what the hell I'm talking about. World bankers is a phrase probably going back almost 75, 80 years ago, talking about bankers that have no allegiance to their country. Well, that's not very unusual. I mean, patriotism is for the rubes, for the masses, the ultra-wealthy, the financial rulers of this country and of the world know that you chase a dollar or chase whatever your currency is anywhere in the world where it goes, and you divert people, as one of our callers was saying about, for instance, about a Barack Obama, by bringing up issues of patriotism. Is he really loyal to our country and crap like that? But the world bankers now are Chinese and Japanese and French and English. So it doesn't make a lot of sense in the way that it did before, which was pretty destructive in terms of trying to really figure out who was holding debt. All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Let's see. Here is Bill. Bill's in Oxford. Go ahead, Bill. You're on the air.
Peter, first time caller and listener for, I just moved back to Detroit. But there's a couple things I agree with you on, but there's one comment I want to make to everybody. The simple solution to the price of gasoline is quit driving so much. If people quit buying so much, the price will go down. That's pretty simple.
Well, it
pretty
is.
Simple economically.
Well, it is, but in fact, I've been trying a little. And I, you know what? I've actually been trying to drive a little slower and not accelerate because I have a full-size car. Silly me. But, you know, I don't want to have a little teeny car when everybody else, or not everybody else, but great numbers of people have these enormous cars, or SUVs and trucks and what have you. I mean, I have a full-size sedan, and half the time I'm stopped at a light or something, and I'm surrounded by these gigundo vehicles. But, you know, we've set up our culture, so, you can't always make that choice. I was saying last week about a friend of mine who lives in the Detroit area. He works in Ann Arbor. It used to cost him $25 a week to drive back and forth, and now it costs him $100. So what can he do? I mean, he can't sell his house here in a Detroit suburb because of what's happening to the housing market. He can't quit his job. So, I mean, yeah, he can cut back a little, but most of us can't cut back that much, do you think?
Well, I think we could carpool a little more and
I agree.
Drive a little less. And these jackrabbit starts that you were talking about, they did a thing on 2020. And if you know, you're at the light and you fly down to the next light, you only get to work 3 to 5 minutes sooner than just drive easy and calm and be polite.
You
don't have to be cutting people off because your car is bigger and all that. But that ain't what I'm really, that ain't really. Gasoline is the least of my problems. You made a comment that really I got to ask you about, okay?
Yeah.
It's something that I never heard before.
Go ahead. Welcome to the
you
show.
You said that Henry Ford
was
friends with Hitler.
Hitler had a photograph of Henry Ford in his bunker in Berlin in 1945. Hitler credited Henry Ford with saving the Nazi Party in the early 1920s when Hitler made an enormous contribution of cash to the I can't remember what year it was, 1922, 1924, something like that, where there, and I'm forgetting my history, something had happened to the Nazi Party that they almost fell on their face. Henry Ford was this virulent anti-Semite. He hated Jews. And he published a newspaper in Dearborn called the Dearborn Independent, and he would publish these horrible lies about Jews across the world, and Hitler loved that. And in fact, in 1938, this is after what's called Kristallnacht, when the Nazis went on this rampage and all across Germany, and the Kristallnacht essentially, and destroyed all the Jewish property and beat up Jews and what have you. Hitler received an Iron Cross in Detroit from the German consulate. So, there's a friend of mine, David Rovics, called, Henry Ford was a Nazi, Henry Ford was a fascist. So there's folk songs. But listen, do you have an internet? Do you have internet access?
No, sir, I don't, but can I say one more thing? No,
sure.
I was going to say,
if you go to my website, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com, and right up at the front, because Prescott Bush, George Bush's grandfather, also aided the Nazis. In that first sentence, you can see a link to Henry Ford's pro-Nazi stuff. But go ahead. What else?
The one comment I want to make is it possible that we just don't vote in favor of someone winning? Is that the attitude to take? I'm just like you. I don't want nobody in there. No, nobody that's out there do I want.
Well,
but regardless of who wins, it doesn't change anything. I mean, they sell themselves out to the highest bidder.
Well, I wonder if I'm going to be curious to see if, like, for instance, Barack Obama wins Is he actually going to change something? I mean, Bush has made everything so bad, you think it would be easy just to go back to start, but we'll see. Well, Bill, welcome to the broadcast. Welcome to calling in. Call us again sometime. I appreciate it. Thanks a lot. Okay, we got some more calls before. Where did I see? Okay, here's Joe in Windsor. Thanks for making our program international. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Peter. Good morning. How's everything?
Everything's good.
Good. I just want to touch base on a couple of things. Being from Windsor, very Americanized, and listening to your local news and so forth. I correct me if I'm wrong, but I was told that I heard something along the lines of a gas tax in the U.S. Per your federal government was to be lifted as of Memorial Day up until Labor Day, an 18 or 19% tax. Is that correct? Have you heard anything about that?
No, but those things won't amount to much. Are you making rude noises?
Yeah, that's my counterpart.
Oh.
I am working, luckily enough. Just the 18% tax, I believe that your government, and I understand that Ms. Clinton was proposing to have that either removed or temporarily lifted as
during,
well.
During the summer, and it turned out that it would save us, I forgot what, under $100, which is okay. But they said what might happen is that will drive up, if the price lowers, people then will go, oh, hey, it's only, $3.40, so I'm going to won't feel so bad about driving
right.
So much.
Yeah. I'm in the same position as you are. I've owned a full size truck, but I've owned it free and clear for the last 8 years. It financially, I'm not in a position to purchase a better, more economical hybrid or a better vehicle on mileage. So I'm stuck with driving a price of product, a V8 engine, 100 liter a tank, which is relatively close to 25 or so gallons. So it's extremely costly. For me to cross over by the time my exchange is completed and shoot over to the duty-free and gas up, I might save $15 to $18. And
yeah, that's not bad. But, of course, now going, can you go to the duty-free without crossing? I can't remember.
No, unfortunately. You have to pay the toll there and back, so it's going to cost you an extra $8.
Yeah.
Last I was told, the exchange was roughly cost me $1.02 for every American dollar.
Really?
So it's still relatively speaking, it was still a bit beneficial me being from Windsor and a border city and so forth. But tough times. I mean, we've discussed about I'm receiving emails in respect to preventing people from purchasing gas from certain suppliers, as I'm sure some people, some previous callers have mentioned, and Petro-Canada being one of our larger local providers. And I paid today I drove on my way into work for my midnight shift, $1.26 a liter, which is, I'm sure, well over $4 or so a gallon.
Well, no, wait, it's over $5 a gallon.
Give or take, it's unbelievable. And Mr. Bush heads out to Saudi Arabia, and they're paying 64 cents a gallon pumping their own oil.
And they
won't do anything for you.
I don't understand. I mean, Canada's a big oil producer. In countries like that, in fact, Iraq, I think gasoline is about $1.25. In Kuwait, it's very cheap. In Caracas, when I was there 2 years ago in Venezuela, gasoline was like 14 cents a gallon. It was cheaper than water. So how come Canada has $5? Is that all just tax?
By far. They claim that each in particular vendor receives anywhere from 3 to 5% of that as a profit only. So they need to pump millions of gallons of fuel a year out of each pump site to actually justify an income. So they broaden it into their typical variety stores and selling cigarettes and milk and so forth. My wife's from Brazil. Just touching base with your trip you're referring to, and their gas is it's like 30 cents a liter. Same concept. They provide for themselves, and I wish somebody would get off their butts and finally make a decision here, because I'm not going to be able to make it into work eventually. It's costing me a day's wages to fill my vehicle up, a full day, 8 hours. I have a newborn son at home, and times are tough.
They are. It ain't good. Thank you, Joe. Appreciate your call. Let's see real quickly here. Apparently, let me see where I just saw that. Stream is up. Let me see. David writes in, He's listening in Texas, like usual. Thank you, David, calling into CallTalkYes at yahoo.com. So I thought we were completely down. I wanted to see a couple more of these. I asked, this is a long one. I'm not going to be able to deal with this. I thought it was, talking about, do you really need premium gas? Because he had written in it. I thought it was BS at first. But reading my book, it does say my engine should have a 91 octane or higher. I drive Mitsubishi Eclipse, and it's technically considered a higher performance engine. Yada, 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 yada. So he says, I guess I'm stuck paying the extra 20 cents till I get a new car. Okay, let me just try one more on this. Tony writes in about premium fuel. The only vehicles that require premium fuel are high-performance vehicles with high-compression engines. Sport bikes, racing motorcycles all require premium fuel. And any automobile currently in production can be run on regular fuel, even though it may say that premium is recommended for best performance. This is because an engine uses a knock sensor on the engine block. If it senses a knock, it dials back the ignition timing in order to prevent engine damage. Huh. That's interesting to know. Because that used to be the sign. If you needed higher octane gas if you were getting engine knock, right? Okay, we're going to take a quick break. Give us a call in the interim. Let me see. One line open. You can get it. 313-298-WRIF. Peter Werbe here with you, and I shall be right back.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
We wanted to give you more on the Riff, but we ran out of somewhere to put it all. We said, screw it. Let's make a whole nother radio station.
What's that sound?
Riff 2. It's music made for the Motor City and totally commercial free. Log on from anywhere in the world at Riff2.com. Everything that rocks. 2008 Harley-Davidson XL1200N Sports Grandmaster, courtesy of Motor City Harley-Davidson. A two-year lease on a 2008 Dodge Ram 1500 Quad Cab Laramie 4x4, courtesy of Oakland Dodge. A trip for two to Harley. We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much, Jalene Jordan, off for the evening. 1 a.m. Eastern Time, because we're getting email at Call Talk. Because Al and Courtney are doing the phones at 313-298-WRIF. But we're getting lots of email at calltalkyes@yahoo.com saying, we are streaming now. Tom in St. Paul just wrote, and so lots of folks. At 1 a.m., it's Mark Bauerlein. He's actually an English prof, so you say, I expect that he would not be happy with people doing the internet and texting and instant messaging and all that. But he's got a book, says, if you're like under 35, you're the dumbest generation. You've heard the greatest generation, World War II. He says, this is the name of his book, The Dumbest Generation, How the Digital Age Stupefies Young Americans and Jeopardizes Our Future. That bad. Also, Air America talk show host, my buddy, Tom Hartman. You go to TomHartman.com. Tom's always doing tremendous stuff. Walking Your Blues Away, How to Heal the Mind and Create Emotional Well-Being. This is something, by the way, that I've actually used. Tom has written books on so many different things. I can't imagine having a mind like him. I admire it. I envy it, actually. But he works at it, too. But in any event, I've actually used the techniques in this book of his. Okay, so where are we now with it all? Okay, here's Mike in Detroit. Mike, hi, it's Peter Werby. Hi, you're on the air.
Oh, thank you. First time caller, I have a pleasure listening to you. I just started working midnights over here downtown Detroit. I was a fourth generation steel worker down in U.S. Steel. And, but what I was, like your caller before was saying, there's nobody out there I really like to vote for. And I don't know why the American people don't start looking more deeply into an independent. They got the Democratic. Like I said, I'm a stout union member. I've always been a union member. And so I was more on the Democratic side. But it seems like the Democrats and the Republicans, it doesn't matter. They're all in bed together. It seems like they just come right down to it. It's all in the same boat. And if we could look in more into an independent person, there's so many different people out there that we can get into office that would definitely run our country a hell of a lot better than what we have.
Well, the problem is the financing of these campaigns. And once it's there, it doesn't matter. I mean, the best Democratic candidate would have been Dennis Kucinich, in my estimation, who would have altered this country so much for the better. Even Ron Paul, who has so many bad sides to him and so many bad policies, he would have been a more representative candidate of the Republican Party. But, of course, even with the amount of money that Ron Paul has been able to raise, he's still like a major distant second, right?
Right.
He may kick up some hell in Minneapolis at the Republican National Convention. I don't think he's going to go gently out of it.
No, I agree with you there, too.
But again, it's not an independent person. I mean, there are some things that are attractive about Barack Obama, but he's always got to, like any candidate, he's always got to make sure that he's not offending this group or that he's not going to, he doesn't want to sound too this. And the same thing. Look at the flip-flops that Grumpy Grandpa McSame has to make and denying some of the things that he said previously about taxes and immigration and a right to choose and stuff like that. I mean, he's got to bite it in order to get along with the Republicans. Wait, just one other thing. What we really need is, and it can't come about, I mean, there are third parties. There's right-wing third parties. There's left-wing third parties. But they're insignificant. I mean, what I do, I vote for the lesser of the two evils. I'd rather have, when people say, well, I don't want any of those people in as president. It's not even so much the people, and I suppose they mean the same thing I do. It's the lack of policies to really dramatically alter things in the manner that they need. But given no choice, I'd rather have the lesser of the two evils in than the greater of the two evils. I mean, I really had to hold my nose when I voted for John Kerry. But, I mean, look at the continuation of the monstrous policies of this racket posing as a government that Bushko has. So, I mean, that's what I do. I mean, the union's got to do something, for instance. The unions are the basis of every alternate party in the world, or particularly in Europe, right?
Correct. As well, like I said, being a fourth-generation union worker, I mean, definitely the unions have done good. I mean, like I said, my great-grandfather, my grandfather, my father, and me, we all worked for the steel company.
Yeah.
And, a lot of the people would be like, well, our union stinks. I mean, wait a minute. You are the union. You people have to get to your union meeting. You have to go there. You know, I really support the American Axle people right now. I know they're going to suffer going through, you know, making $200 a week walking around a trash can, but I'm glad that they're sticking up for their rights. You know, a lot of these people, because of the debts that they're in and everything else, they just take whatever the company throws at them. So I really do respect the American Axle people for going ahead and standing up for their rights.
Well, let me tell you this. There is, a tentative agreement has been reached between the UAW and American Axle. And I can't believe the UAW signed on to this. The American Axle wanted to cut the $28 wage an hour in half. And people go, $28 an hour, that's a fortune. I mean, that's $56,000 a year. I mean, that's just barely make it into the middle class. And they've agreed, the UAW has agreed, that they would cut wages as low as $14.35 an hour up to $18.50 an hour. So, I'm curious to see whether the local 235, they're going to vote, I guess, on Thursday, and I guess local 262, whether they're actually going to buy into this.
Yeah, I believe they will, but, I mean, like I said, it tends to the people becoming independent on that. And that's like me. I made like almost close to $80,000 last year.
Mm-hmm.
But that was living in a factory. I have no life. I mean, I worked a swing shift, and then I'd be forced over. I was working 16 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Yeah, that's
just insane. Just to make that. And,
yeah.
I mean, I made good money, and I thank God that I had the job. But it's like, even now it's tough. I'm a single man, and I can't even imagine having a family and having to deal with all these. I just downgraded I had a full-size pickup. I got rid of it. I got me a nice little Saturn, a little four-cylinder, 30 miles a gallon.
There you go.
So, but thank you for taking my call.
Well, that's what I'm here for. Thank you. Appreciate it. We were talking about unions last week, and Cristobal wrote into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. He says, I can't agree with you about the wages union workers receive. They chose their job field. Without an education, that's where you're stuck within our society. They need to stop crying and work two or three jobs like myself. And by the way, I had my share of labor work, which I don't know what union, but any. They should stop crying and work two or three jobs like myself. I mean, Cristobal, you shouldn't have to work two or three jobs to get a decent wage. All of this was fought out beginning like in the 1880s and certainly in the 1930s. And are we going to start over again? Are we going to go back to wages that aren't adequate to give people a decent life? Are we going to have people working like our last caller that has to work 7 days a week? 12 hours a day? Yeah, I mean, this doesn't make any sense. We got people, they just, Sotheby's, this big auction house in New York, just sold a painting for a living artist, a guy named Lucian Freud, sold it for $33 million for a painting. So you have that kind of wealth on one hand here in this country. Oh, I'd like that up in my house. It's a nice nude. Here's $33 million for it. On the other hand, you have a company destroying the wage standards and the standard of living of hundreds and maybe thousands of workers in the Detroit area, sending them from the middle class downward. So this is class warfare. This is what the wealthy do with their money. I mean, they don't all. Well, I guess the one half of 1% does do things like buy $33 million paintings. And their class warfare is to destroy the wage structure of American workers, drive millions of people out of the middle class. Maybe they only want white-collar workers in there. or, you know, owners, maybe 20% of the population. The rest of us can go thatch our roofs, right? Mike from Redford writes in, I've been listening to Night Call since the Sheila Rushlow days. She was one of the talk show hosts back a ways, maybe in the 70s. I wanted to say that if I hear one more idiot complain about what a union auto worker makes, I'm going to scream. The Republicans are laughing their asses off that these working stiffs do their dirty work for them. As soon as the unions fail, the Walmart people will get a big wage cut as well, and don't even think about benefits. Things are really bad right now, and it looks like they're going to get worse. The last thing we should be doing is fighting with our fellow workers over crumbs that big business throws our way. He says, I've been in the building trades for 25 years, and as was my father and grandfather. Because of the unions, three generations of my family were raised in a decent environment, and we worked hard for it. Thanks and keep up the good work. Pardon me. Just maybe you might educate one of these dummies. He's a member of the Plasterers, local number 67, for 25 years. And if the UAW, I mean, maybe it's just blackmail. It's the kind of thing where they say, we'll move the company somewhere else, because increasingly that's the class war that the owners are practicing upon us, the middle class and the working class. They'll say, either you've got to eat it big time. I mean, can you imagine someone saying you got to cut your wages in half? We're paying our CEO millions of dollars, but you're going to work for $14.35 an hour. And there's many of you out there say, $14.35 an hour? I'd love to work for $14.35 an hour. Minimum wage should be $13.45 an hour. I mean, working in a factory, what does that give them? $28 an hour, $56,000 a year. I mean, for those of you who haven't worked in a factory, and I haven't, but I know people that have, and I've, believe it or not, seen factory work, they should be getting $150,000 a year. Here's Rubik in Waterford. Hi, you're on the air.
Good, how are you?
Good.
Good. I was just calling about gas prices.
Sure.
Yeah, I was up in the UP just this past weekend, and it was $4.05 a gallon.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, it was nuts. It was outrageous.
And those people drive a lot.
Drive and drive.
Yeah, that's the way it is in the UP. All right, here's Jeff in Detroit. Go ahead, Jeff. You're on the air.
Hey, Pete. How's it going?
Going well.
Hey, I called to say that, you know, the government has always used entertainment and everything to distract the people. I think back to the Roman gladiator days where they used the gladiator games to keep the people distracted and keep their minds off of a lot of the political things going on. And today it's no different.
They have American Gladiator, don't they?
Actually, they do.
Yeah, they do. And then they got American Idol.
Yeah, and all these things to keep people's mind off of the things that are going on in the country. And like the caller called earlier, you know, It just boggles your mind with all the problems going on in the world, and people are more concerned about somebody's haircut or who's doing what, you know, rather than something that's substantial.
Well, you know, but it gets back to, I mean, why are people, you'd think, now, wait a minute, are people that dumb that they would rather watch American Idol than try to improve their circumstances, improve the country, you know, just pure self-interest about the economy and their own economic circumstances. For one thing, people, you can watch American Idol and also, for instance, be politically active. But the other thing is, and what I keep saying over and over, is that the mechanism for getting to all this or to be effective politically. I mean, we talk about the 1930s, or you know, I frequently do, and I talk about the union movement. Or that during the 1830s and 40s, there was the anti-slavery movement. Or in the, you know, the 1870s and 80s, there was the suffragette movement to get women to vote, on and on. There was the anti-war movement during World War I and the Vietnam War. And movement is a key word. There's not a movement here. And that's what we gotta, create. Thank you, Jeff. I'm going to go through the calls kind of quickly here. Let's see. People calling in for or writing in. Your signal is good here in Washington State, writes David. Gas here in Walla Walla, 3.87, 387.9. Yeah, like your show. Wish you were on more often. Oh, I'm too lazy for that. It's All right. Okay. Let's go back. Yeah, here's Kathy in Southfield. Kathy, thanks for joining me. You're on the air.
Oh, your last caller was right on. I suggest your listeners Google Trilateral Commission, started by one of the Rockefellers in the 70s. It was an organization that is open, no conspiracy, that basic goal is to formulate economic policy for the world. And let's face it, since this country's inception and probably since time began, it is wealth and power that run the world. Another book I would suggest people to check out is The Good Society by John Galbraith, where he states that inflation is a bigger threat to the wealthy than unemployment, that they don't really care how many people are unemployed.
No, they don't.
And a book that I'm looking forward to reading, I've not read yet, is Jesse Ventura, Don't Start the Revolution Without Me.
Yeah. Jesse Ventura is talking, he may run for the Senate in Minnesota.
Who knows? I mean, he is not bought by any of these Rockefellers. You know, he's not bought by the power elite.
Hey, Kathy, up here, and I've only got about 4 minutes left for the whole show, and I want to try to get to everybody. What it says, Ford Motor Company apologizes. What's that all about?
Well, they, some very recently, they apologized
to the pond.
Uh-huh.
And just in that general statement, what's the government making for the oil that we import and the money they're making on the grain that we export to the countries, and how that affects us as the citizens, voicing our opinion for the high oil prices and making the big three now make smaller cars, which the government's been trying to do for a long time, as we sit on oil that we don't have as our big reserves they talk about.
Yeah. All right, thank you, sir. I don't think I'm going to comment. I won't be able to get everybody in. Here's Adam and Romulus. Adam, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Peter.
Hi.
Let me say here first that I switched my careers from delivering pizza, minimum wage job plus tips, to flipping hamburgers because I can walk to flip hamburgers.
There you go.
Okay, right down the road, I live by the airport. 409 for over a week, and also the most important thing, the reason I called, people need to know that, you know, these commercials, they're talking about changing energy program for the future, and they're talking about 16,000 green jobs. This legislation is that they're trying to promote is going to allow them to drastically raise your utility rates on electricity without the government being able to react to it in nearly the way they can now. Huge 70% of what the big companies pay is going to be shifted to consumers.
Sure. What that those ads that have been appearing or playing all over town have been our energy company ads, and in that manner they actually are dishonest. But thanks for bringing that up. Let's see. Here is Matt Niekors. Matt, hi. You're on the air.
Hey, how's it going, Pete?
Going good.
I just wanted to comment on one of the callers that called a little bit ago. He worked at U.S. Steel.
Uh-huh.
I do as well. Like you said, you got to work 16 hours and make 80 grand. I made 80 grand last year. I have two kids at home. It's tough. And I voted for Dennis Kucinich. Thanks.
All right. Well, thank you very much. Yeah, you should be able to make 80,000 and work 40 hours, and like our other caller said, and have a life. Here's Philip in Novi. Hi, Philip. You're on the air.
Yes, hi, Pete. How do you get off saying that people should just get $80,000 a year and only have to work 40 hours? I'm a carpenter. I work for myself. I work my tail off. Where do you think this money's going to come from?
We have this enormously wealthy country. I mean, the amount of wealth that is in the upper 20% but of the population, the upper 10%, the upper 5% is enormous. There ought to be that people shouldn't have to work their tails off. Why not having a slogan, workers of the world, relax? I mean, why do people have to work two and three jobs? Why do people work like hell and wind up getting $20,000 a year? It doesn't make a bit of sense. All right, I got to go home, unfortunately. We'll have to take this up another day. All right, I'm sorry for those of you who got left on hold. Kevin and Chris, my apologies to you. We like to try to get everybody in. But stay tuned. A couple of very interesting guests. This is might PO a lot of you. In fact, maybe I should have even had it on at the beginning of the show. Mark Bauerlein says people under 35, under 30, the dumbest generation. How the digital age stupefies young Americans and jeopardizes our future. Tom Hartman, also on after him, author of Walking Your Blues Away, How to Heal the Mind and Create Emotional Well-Being. I'll be back next week, as will Jalene Jordan. Thanks for listening. Thanks for calling. Stay tuned for the interviews.
This is WRIN.com.
The Rick satisfies your need for speed with racing action that rocks. Memorial Day weekend rocks as 101 WRIF and Firestone present exclusive IMS radio network coverage of the 92nd running of the Indianapolis 500 Sunday, May 25th, starting at noon. In 2008, 101 WRIF is your home for Indianapolis Motor Speedway Network race coverage from the green all the way to the checkered flag. The granddaddy of them all, the Indianapolis 500, live from the Brickyard. Presented by Firestone. Firestone, presenting sponsor of the Detroit Indy Grand Prix on 101 WRIF. The Riff.
Dodge and your Harley Fest 2008 station. 101 WRIF. Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. Many of us have heard the phrase, the greatest generation. It refers to that generation of World War II that made so many sacrifices, both economically during the Depression and then during the war era. And there's been all sorts of generations since the X generation. Well, the boomers, of course, first, and the X generation, the Y generation. We're talking about the millennial generation now. But here's a book that came my way that I thought really brought up some issues that are very dear to my heart as well. The book's called The Dumbest Generation. How the Digital Age Stupefies Young Americans and Jeopardizes Our Future. The author is Mark Bauerlein, and Mark Bauerlein is a professor of English at Emory University in Atlanta. He's worked as a director of research and analysis at the National Endowment for the Arts. He's overseen studies about culture in American life and also has had his writing appear in the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, the San Francisco Chronicle. He's been on lots of TV shows, including CNN and the CBS Evening News. He's on the road with his book right now. Mark Bauerlein, welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
Thank you, Peter. Glad to join you.
Well, you know, I'm kind of putting the cart way before the horse because this you'd think would be at the end of this. But in your book, you say that we shouldn't worry, you and me, because I share a lot of these concerns that you do in the Dumbest Generation, that we shouldn't be concerned about being considered old fogies and ought to really address young people about the concerns that you have in your book. But probably the title doesn't invite them in, does it?
We will. It certainly doesn't. And we can add another subtitle for the book, which is Don't Trust Anyone Under 30. And that is, you know, obviously a provocation. And it really lays out, I think, an attitude that more elders should take on this issue and a different approach toward the juniors in our society. People have said to me, look, Mark, older people have been complaining about younger people for generations. This always takes place. And I say, yes, they do. And for that to take place, I believe, is actually a healthy sign in any society. It's good for older people to criticize younger people for their ignorance and their inexperience and their hubris. And it is also a healthy sign for younger people to resent that judgment and to look upon elders as being perhaps too rigid or too authoritarian over the kids, and that in the best cases each generation ends up tempering some of the worst tendencies of the other, and so each generation really has a responsibility to assume a critical posture toward the other generation and towards themselves. And I think what has happened, among other things, today is that too many of the older generation coming out of the youth culture of the 60s looked upon agedness with some suspicion. Remember the motto of the 1960s, don't trust anyone over 30.
That's right.
Well, all those people are over 30 now.
Way over.
And so They still retain a lot of the youth-oriented attitudes, and the last thing they want to be considered is cranky, curmudgeonly, obsolete, dinosaur-like, and that in my world, at least, we see way too much indulgence of youth, way too much hesitation to criticize adolescents for their precisely adolescence.
Well, you mentioned the phrase elders, and that really isn't one that's used very frequently in our society. It's usually the older generation or seniors, and we're either out to pasture or about to be, and I can't even remember the Bob Dylan line, but some of you can't get out of the way, essentially. And that's been, maybe even since the teenage rebellion of the 1950s, certainly into the 1960s, that the older generation, the generation with power at a given time, are always an impediment to real important progressive change, and hence that attitude. So, and I guess I would say, I like the title of your book. I'm all for provocation, but I guess I began with saying that a young person, if you said, "Look, you're the dumbest generation," it's not going to get a very good hearing. I guess.
Sure. And the thing to do is to clarify, why are they the dumbest generation?
Sure.
Not because they're less intelligent. They're just as smart as generations have ever been. They're just as ambitious. In fact, more of them are going to college than ever before. Also, they have other advantages. They have better attitudes toward their parents. They have good behavioral measures, such as lower rates of violent crime. So we have some good things going on with them. Also, they have more spending money than ever before. Generation Y is a marketer's dream because they do have so much discretionary spending. They're a nightmare because it's so hard to predict where their tastes are going to go. But added to that, we have them growing up in a society in which there are more opportunities to gain knowledge and skills than ever before. Sometimes when we pass through the grocery checkout line and look at the magazines, we think our culture couldn't be getting too much dumber. But in fact, we have more museums today than ever before, more historic sites. We have more colleges than ever before. We have more libraries. And, of course, we have the Internet, which is instant access to great artworks, old books, government documents, current affairs, foreign affairs, geography, maps, paintings. Everything else is there with a double click. So the access has never been higher. The money has never been higher. So the advantages are all there. And when we talk about the knowledge economy, young kids are told all the time, learn more, become more adept, more verbal, better vocabulary, become skilled in the ways of current affairs, the economy, finance, trade, and so on. So everything is pushing them toward becoming more skilled and learned. All the ingredients are in place for an informed, engaged, younger citizenry. And yet, the illumination hasn't happened in measures of young people's knowledge of history and civics. It's abysmal. Every time they give the national exams in history to high school seniors, more than half of them score below basic, which is essentially an F.
Well, Mark Bauerlein, let me ask you this. In your book, The Dumbest Generation, you cite a number of very, very worrying statistics about knowledge. More than half of 17-year-olds can't place the Civil War as occurring in the second half of the 19th century. But I wonder how these, and maybe you could name a few others of the specific historical dates or personages that shocked you, so to speak, and compare it, though, to, say, 30 years ago and 50 years ago and 100 years ago. I mean, are we actually dumber or the young people this time? Do they know less about history and sociology and what have you than previous generations?
Most definitely the average high school graduate today knows less about those traditional areas of history and civics than the average high school graduate did in 1955. There's one study that compares this. We see literacy rates have actually dropped in the last 15 years for younger adults, for college-educated adults. They know less. For people going to college, more and more of them are ending up in remedial writing and reading classes. If you go up to Michigan State University and ask the admissions office how many of the students entering there have to go into remedial reading and writing courses and math courses, they will roll their eyes and shake their heads and say, this is a huge burden, a big cost, because we are teaching things now that should have been taught even down in eighth and ninth grade at this point. If you ask employers today what they see are the knowledge and skill levels of recent graduates, people just coming into the workplace, they will complain endlessly about bad grammar, bad writing skills, bad communication skills, and bad reading skills. And so I think that there are certain areas of adeptness with technology that we find kids have far more than their seniors have.
Mm-hmm. You're a professor of English at Emory University in Atlanta. Anecdotally, what do you see when I don't know what level you teach at,
right.
But what are your experiences?
Well, if you polled college teachers, you'd have to go a pretty long time before you found one who said that entering freshmen write better and read more widely than they did 20 years ago. What happens is that the reading and writing habits that they form in the most popular activities that they do on the internet, which is social networking, give them a certain quick facility. They can skim things very quickly. They can write little notes very quickly. But if you ask them to develop a coherent argument, to draft a complete paragraph, if you look at their vocabulary levels, you'd be disappointed every time. And this is because they are communicating with one another in these zones. Social networking is what the Internet is really about for most of them. The Internet doesn't open them up to the world of ideas, to the universe of the past, to history, to foreign affairs, other governments, and so on. It opens them up to contact with one another. That's what adolescents care about. A 16-year-old doesn't care about what a 45-year-old thinks. A 16-year-old cares about what the other 16-year-olds in homeroom think. They don't care about what happened 150 years ago in the Civil War. They care about what happened last week at the party between Bobby and Betty.
Well, but that the same thing was true with you and I when we were teenagers, at least with me. I shouldn't speak for you, but what you say in your book, The Dumbest Generation, is that there's so much more access to the personal now because of technology.
Exactly. Peter, I'm 49 years old, and my social day ended when I left school, played basketball with some buddies, and then went home. And when I crossed the front door and went inside, that was it. 6 o'clock, I had dinner. I had to have some contact with parents. There was the landline, as it's now called, but I didn't feel like, oh, I've now got to call my friends and see what's going on. I didn't have a cell phone, no laptops, no email, no instant messaging. Now, kids go home and they go up to their rooms, which are multimedia centers. And what does the media do? Well, the laptop has the email, they got the handheld, the BlackBerry, the cell phone, so that social contact, peer-to-peer connection is 24/7. And they can sit in their bedrooms at midnight with that laptop open and carrying out a chat with a buddy down the street and a buddy 1,000 miles away.
So we're talking about a social setting, a social matrix in which the norm is texting. I mean, for full disclosure, I don't even have an answering machine on my phone. I don't have a cell phone. I don't know how to text. And I think I'm pretty well connected. But when we're talking about people in their teens and now into their 20s and even into their 30s, texting is what hooks people together. It is the social milieu. To not be involved in it, unfortunately, is to be the weirdo outsider.
Exactly. If you ask an 18-year-old to go 6 hours without checking the cell phone, without looking at the personal profile page, without getting or sending any messages, anxiety sets in. Go to a college kid. Go up to the University of Michigan. And go out on one of the quads and watch the kids passing by between classes and count the number of them that got the cell phone to their ears, or they're looking at the little cell phone screen and typing in a message. They've got 10 minutes between classes and they've got to check in to see what's going on. They have to find out where everyone is meeting that night. They have to hear the latest news on whatever the gossip is for that week. And if they're not checking in, if they don't have a Facebook page, yeah, it's the equivalent of not getting picked to play kickball in sixth grade, and you have to sit on the bench while everyone has fun.
The book is The Dumbest Generation, How the Digital Age Stupefies Young Americans and Jeopardizes Our Future, or Don't Trust Anyone Under 30. The author is my guest on The Peter Werbe Show, Mark Bauerlein. And you can go to dumbestgeneration.com. I'll be giving that again at the end of our interview. Also, it'll be on my site, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E, .com. At your Emory University classes, I know professor friends of mine are always debating whether to allow laptops, and they say, we're taking notes, and then they always suspect that they're really checking their email. Do you allow, laptops and or cell phone, which then people are texting, into your classes?
You know, this is the first semester in which I have considered refusing laptops into the classroom, because the first time I sat there at the top row in my Survey of American Literature class, a lot of the kids have their laptops open, and they are always in the back. And when you look at them, and you're talking about some serious work of literature, the end of a story when Edna commits suicide in the novel The Awakening, and you see kids up in the front row, and they're smiling. They're not taking notes on this novel. They just got a message. They just learned something. They saw a joke pass by their screen. So we may have to cancel all laptops in class.
Well,
if that continues.
Your title, The Dumbest Generation, I never quite put it in those terms, but we're supposed to be living in the so-called information age, and like you, it doesn't appear to me that at least that people aren't any smarter. I mean, you're making the assertion that, in fact, that it's a dumbing down, and to me, it is the noise, in a sense, the inability. I mean, I'm sort of ADD to begin with, so unfortunately, I'm in an industry that doesn't penalize that. But the idea to be able to focus and to sit and read and to reflect, to read a page in your book and go, wait a minute, let me read that again, or wait a minute, how does that fit in with what he said on page 52 and I'm on page 181 and go back to it? You can't do that online. So there is an entire new, I can't remember what the word for it is. There's a different cognitive manner in which people are assembling information and remembering it.
This is what they talk about with multitasking. And the simple fact is that in an average 15-year-old's life, the idea of sitting down for 90 minutes with a book in a room with no interruptions, that simply doesn't figure. That just doesn't happen. There's always a cell phone call coming through. There's an email. There's an instant message you need to check. And also, there's the TV show that you want to hear, or the iPod that has to be programmed. So those spaces of reflection and disconnection, those simply aren't there. And a lot of them, in terms of their cognitive habits, begin to feel a little bit uncomfortable. It's irritating if you don't have that stimulation coming in, if you're not in touch. They simply don't like it.
What is the negative here, though? You and I can tell, share a sense that to be able to perceive the world in complex terms and in logical terms makes a lot of sense. But some people might say, who cares? I don't care when the Civil War of the United States was fought. I want to check with my buddy. Or to me, we have a virtual community. You guys have your nose stuck in a book. I'm texting friends across the country, maybe even across the world. You guys are so 20th century.
Exactly. Well, the thing we can do is put this in some civic terms and say that when you are a citizen in a democracy, you bear a burden of knowledge that you do not bear if you live in an aristocracy or a monarchy or a theocracy or a totalitarian state. One of the first things that totalitarians do when they take over a society is to erase the memory of the past. What does the memory of the past give people in a democracy? Well, one thing, it gives them heroes. It gives them villains. It gives them origins of civic ideals. We have our founding documents, and we keep those in mind. We have to replenish these in our own lives every time we vote, every time we think about Supreme Court challenges to certain laws, when we look at national policies. And if we don't have a memory of the past for those, then we only respond to them in present circumstances, which means we're only consulting our own needs, our own interests. And this is not good for the civic health of the republic. If we don't remember the example of Abraham Lincoln and of Teddy Roosevelt, what standard do we apply to our political leaders of the present? By how much they take care of us? By certain policies or where they stand on the political spectrum? Well, all those things do count, but there are also certain standards, enduring standards. And if you don't remember the figures from the past, you don't have those standards at hand. And so a democracy filled with people who don't revere their political and cultural inheritance, well, they end up getting the government they deserve. They end up getting the leaders they deserve.
You know, I just looked in the bibliography of your book, is that what you were saying reminded me of Neil Postman's book, Amusing Ourselves to Death. And there's a subtitle to that that's something or other in the age of... But in any event, what sticks out the most in my mind, talking about politics, he talks about the Lincoln-Douglas debate and how these ordinary people came. When I say ordinary, I mean we usually think of people from 100 and whatever... 50 years ago as being limited in their ability to, in their intellectual abilities. Yet these were people who sat and stood and heard 2 one-hour presentations, essentially written essays by each of the candidates, Lincoln and Douglas, then were told to go home for dinner and come back for the rebuttals, which were each another half hour or 45 minutes apiece.
Mm-hmm.
No one could do that today.
This was a form of civic engagement that everyone accepted as part of the nature of American democracy. When Alexis de Tocqueville toured America, he was a dispossessed French aristocrat who came to America in the 1820s and then wrote about it in a great book called Democracy in America. He was amazed at the way in which in these distant frontier towns, people would gather when a newspaper would arrive. And someone would read the entire page of the newspaper giving information about what is going on in Congress and what's going on in foreign affairs, and they would debate it. So this was actually a community event, and everyone looked forward to this, and that this is one of the things that he found is amazing about American democracy. When Lincoln gave the Gettysburg Address, you know, the famous thing was he spoke for 2 minutes and he followed someone who spoke for a couple of hours. Well, the fact is that the man who gave the address for 2 hours, that was the norm. And people came and they wanted to hear those speeches go on. Lincoln's speech was an anomaly.
Well, we are getting towards the end of things, and probably, as I remember when I interviewed, I'm trying to think of the man who, Four Arguments for the Elimination of Television, he said, turn it off. I don't think too many people have, and this book was from the same period as Neil Postman's, not very many people have listened to his admonition. What do you expect? What do you expect out of all this? In other words, this is all expanding. It's not contracting.
I think on the macro level, Peter, that there is nothing to be done. That we have to look on the micro level, and so parents and teachers affect their children and their students. So what parents need to do is after dinner each day, you simply say, we're all going to sit in a room and we're all going to read our own thing. You can read anything you want. It doesn't have to be schoolwork. You can read a cheap, you know, romance novel, whatever. But for 1 hour, you're going to disconnect. No networking, no cell phone, no screens. And after that hour is over, you can go do whatever you want. So it's a question of balance, but parents have to be vigilant about carving out a space against all the incursions of social life.
I'm smiling here because I remember after dinner being essentially forced to listen to classical music and just hating. I couldn't wait to get away from it. It probably took me 20 or 30 years to get back into enjoying symphonic music. I'm not disagreeing with you. I'm just worried because I actually share the identical concerns that you have because through the shallow level of the way people are assembling knowledge and information these days, it's really much, much more open. The person's much, much more open to being manipulated by these different messages. That's one of the main concerns in politics, in consumer choices.
Peter, I can't hear any Wagner without a shudder of remembrance of all those Saturday mornings when I was awakened by my father blasting those thundering strains of the Valkyries throughout the household. So yes. But look, if you say to kids, look, pick your reading matter, Harry Potter,
sure,
or whatever you want. I think the important thing is not to talk about the value of certain books, but to, again, carve a space of seclusion for an hour. I mean, this is how you build study habits. This is how they're going to be able to go into the library when they're 19 years old in college and work on that paper without being interrupted every 5 minutes, because that's what you have to do if you're going to write a good paper. So it's creating patterns in the day, creating a rhythm in their lives that disconnects them for a time from their friends. And I think what they'll find is they may look forward to it. A lot of these kids are overwhelmed by all this social contact, and it becomes a rat race for them. And I actually sympathize. We know that middle school can be a gauntlet of judgments, and these kids have fragile egos, and a rejection can be crushing to them. To create a private zone for them where it's just them and a book.
More? Yeah, I'm sorry. Excuse me. I didn't mean to cut you off like that, but we are unfortunately out of time. I could talk about this probably for another 2 hours. A better way, though, get the book, The Dumbest Generation, How the Digital Age Stupefies Young Americans and Jeopardizes Our Future. Another subtitle, or Don't Trust Anyone Under 30. Mark Bauerlein has been my guest. It's published by Tarcher Penguin. You can go to dumbestgeneration.com, also to my website, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com. Mark Bauerlein, thanks for being on the program.
Enjoyed it.
This is WRIF.com.
Friday, May 16th, the finals of the 2008 Riff Rock Girl Search, featuring the return of Future. With special guest, Red.
Vote for your favorite now at WRAF.com.
Then, see the final four contestants at the Royal Oak Music Theater as the next Riff Rock Girl is chosen. Doors open at 7 p.m. All ages welcome. Free tickets still available. Get them at the Royal Oak Music Theater box office, oldtickets.com outlets, online at tickets.com, aeglive.com, or charge at 800-919-6272. Transportation provided by Love Dodge Limousines. Call 800-A-LIMO for you, or click on LAVDAS.com. Hair and makeup provided by Six Salon, where it's all about you, in Royal Oak, Birmingham, in their newest location inside the MGM Grand Detroit Casino and Hotel. WRIS 2008 Riff Rock Girl Finals, featuring Filter with special guest Red, live in concert Friday, May 16th. Brought to you by Bud Light.
Bud Light keeps it coming.
Wireless Toys,
your cellular superstore.
And 101 WRIS.
Everything that rocks.
Thank you very much for joining me. A pleasure to be with you. I want to bring back to the Peter Werbe Show someone who I have interviewed any number of times, but probably, unless your memory stretches way back to this program, someone you associate with the politics of today, one of the great commentators of our era who has made an incredible splash in talk radio. His name's Tom Hartman. He's joining me from Portland. Tom, welcome back to the Peter Werbe Show.
Hey, Peter, it's a pleasure and an honor to be on with you.
I wanted to get you on right away because it's going to take me the longest time in the world to list all your creds here. I'll just do a few of them. We've talked to you about so many of your books. The last one just it seems like about a month or so ago, Screwed, The Undeclared War on the Middle Class, and we talked with you about your Kennedy assassination book that you co-authored, Ultimate Sacrifice, John and Robert Kennedy Planned for a Coup in Cuba and the Murder of JFK. It's called Ultimate Sacrifice. We interviewed you about We the People, The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight. And when I know this always kind of embarrasses you, but when I say you're the hardest working man in show business and talk radio, you certainly deserve the title. Tom Hartman, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
And here, uncharacteristically, a thin volume, and as I said at the beginning, not about politics per se, but really about sort of internal politics, who we are and how we deal with what happens to us, particularly psychic trauma. All of us have experienced bad things in our lives, a loss, a sense of failure, a sense of humiliation. And this thin volume speaks to this state that we find our minds in frequently and how we can do something about it. The book is called Walking Your Blues Away, How to Heal the Mind and Create Emotional Well-Being. And I bet you, Tom Hartman, tons of ears just perked up because a lot of our minds need healing, don't they? Probably mine as well. But
I think all of ours.
Yes.
All of ours.
But this is an amazing book because it's essentially it's using a common everyday practice, something most of us do all the time, to change our psyche. Give us kind of an overview of it.
Sure. The other thing that the book does, by the way, is it exposes that kind of has a negative connotation, I suppose. It enlightens why Sigmund Freud stopped using the most successful psychological technique that he had in his arsenal in 1798, why he stopped using hypnosis and started all sorts of weird things like giving cocaine to all of his patients and coming up with theories of edible and electric complexes and penis envy and dream interpretation and talking therapies that, for all practical purposes, didn't work very well or didn't work anywhere near as successfully as hypnosis has. And this has been an enduring mystery, is, you know, why, starting in 1898, from that time until the day he committed suicide, why did Sigmund Freud abandon his most successful psychological technique? And I think this book, for the first time, answers that question. It's one of the great mysteries of modern medicine and science. And so, in any case, what the thesis of the book is that, first of all, that psychologically we are self-healing organisms just like we are physically. You know, if you cut your hand, it'll bleed for a while, and then a scar will form, or a scab will form, and then eventually the scab will fall off, and a scar will be there. And if you wait long enough, even the scar will vanish, and then the body will just basically become whole again. And all but the largest scars typically, you know, slowly get replaced. Even scar tissue gets replaced.
Mm-hmm.
And so the question is, why isn't that true of psychological trauma, if that's true of physical trauma? And the answer is that, to a large extent, it is. I mean, you know, most of us have had miserable experiences in our lives that are now distant memories and that we've dealt with and that we've processed. But there are some that just don't go away, or some that persist.
Well, the phrase is time heals all wounds, but not necessarily.
That's right,
yeah.
Particularly psychologically.
Right.
And so when it's time for an intervention, what kind of intervention is necessary? And might it be that historically societies have had techniques to deal with psychological trauma, which were actually pretty necessary? Because, you know, people, you know, if you and me and Zog over there were to go out on a hunting party 10,000 years ago and the saber-toothed tiger ate Zog, we're going to be pretty traumatized if we stood there and watched, you know, our friend getting eaten by a giant beast. And so how do we deal with that? How do we you know, get through that that trauma? And what I found was that there's a long history of what I refer to as bilateral activities that have been used by Aboriginal societies, Indigenous societies all over the world, typically in the form of dancing or walking, that are part of healing mechanism. And by bilateral, I mean left side, right side, left side, right side, left side, right side, moving back and forth. And that there is this fascinating school that started with Franz Anton Mesmer in the 1800s. Or in the 1700s, which was about the time that we stopped walking in a big way. I mean, you know, it's all over the world. People were traveling on horses and horse gun. Of course, that goes back for quite a ways. But as people stopped walking, they started carrying these wounds. And so Mesmer came up with this idea that he could channel the power of the moon into people's heads and heal them. And so he would put his left hand up in the air, and he'd have you lay on the couch, and with his right hand, he would wave it in front of your face from left to right and left to right and say, follow, you know, focus your eyes onto my hand and feel the energy going into your head. And he would move his hand back and forth, and people's eyes would move left to right and left to right and left to right. And it healed all kinds of things. I mean, this was a major big deal. This was probably one of the prime healing modalities in Europe and the Americas in the 1700s. In fact, Ben Franklin went over to Paris to see a demonstration of this. He was part of a group of scientists who investigated it. And Mesmer called it mesmerism. And it was quite the fad. I mean, not just a fad. It became a widely and broadly accepted healing method.
Healing for what, Tom? Now, what do we?
Well, back in those days, it was this category of diseases known as hysteria, which included, you know, muteness and fainting, and basically things that today we would call psychosomatic illnesses and psychological illnesses.
Okay.
He never claimed that he could cure syphilis. He knew that he couldn't, but he could do tremendous things with people who had what today would be recognized as the symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder, or just weird symptoms that would pop out. Nobody knows why. Oddly, fainting, for example, was a very common condition back then, both among men and women, particularly among women. And this would be a cure for that as well. So I think, you know, things come out in different ways as time changes. Culture affects how we manifest our wounds, but. In any case, so in 1824, there was a psychiatrist from Scotland by the name of James Braid, who had been trained in mesmerism, and Mesmer was still alive, but he had retired to Austria, where he was kind of hiding out in the woods, but his technique had traveled around the world a dozen times. And James Braid said, you know, this is crazy. This has got nothing to do with the moon. This has to do with fatigue of the eye muscles. And it doesn't, you know, it isn't that some people are good at it and some people aren't because they can do a better job of channeling lunar energy. And the way that he proved it was by taking a pocket watch, which would disconnect the person, you know, from the process. In other words, putting a mechanical device in the path and saying to the person, watch the pocket watch as it swings back and forth rather than my hand, and not putting his other hand up in the air to get the moon energy. And sure enough, people were just as effectively healed. He would have the watch move back and forth in front of their eyes while he would talk with them about their trauma or whatever it may be. And
now, this sounds like
hypnosis.
Yeah.
And in fact, James Braid invented the word. He originally called it neurohypnosis, and then he shortened it to hypnosis in 1825 or 26. And in 1824, he made the initial discovery, and then he published a paper on it. And he's regarded as the father of modern hypnosis. And by the 1860s, 1870s, hypnosis was used as one of the principal methods for inducing anesthesia during surgery. It was used for psychological healing. It was one of the primary psychiatric modalities. So when Sigmund Freud came along, and he started practicing medicine as a psychiatrist in the 1880s, and when he came along, he was, of course, trained in hypnosis. And in his first book that he co-authored with Joseph Brouwer called Studies on Hysteria, which is his most famous work, Freud talks about how the hypnosis is the most powerful technique for doing a definitive analysis, a diagnosis, finding out what's wrong with somebody, and for curing people. And he sings the praises of hypnosis all through the book, and how, you know, this is the technique, this is what you use. And this book came out in 1896. And so here's Freud, and he's doing this, and he's using it, and it's very effective. And in fact, the entire book is mostly about this Anna O case, this one particular case, and talking about how wonderful, and several other papers, shorter papers that Freud published in 1896 and 1897, most of them with Joseph Brouwer, about hypnosis. And then all of a sudden, in 1898, Freud stops using hypnosis and starts giving all of his patients cocaine.
Mm-hmm.
And the word hypnosis literally vanished from his vocabulary in 1898 and never appeared again until the day he committed suicide in the, I think it was the early 1930s.
Tom Harbin, let me just interrupt because you went over something pretty quickly. Let me just verify this is historically accurate, is that Freud then began utilizing cocaine as a, both using it himself and also administering it to his patients as an idea that that he could find some cure. We don't quite see it that way today. In fact, let me reintroduce you. My guest is Tom Hartman. He's the award-winning, best-selling author of more than a dozen books, including a brand-new one, Walking Your Blues Away. That's what we're talking about. Subtitled, How to Heal the Mind and Create Emotional Well-Being. And although I've interrupted the story, Tom, tell us, you know, in fact, one of the points that I didn't make in introducing you, you're a nationally syndicated talk show host. You're heard in almost 70 cities. You're as well as doing a local show in the mornings in Portland. And so how does Tom Hartman become a therapist?
Well, back in the late 70s, I was the executive director of a residential treatment facility for severely emotionally disturbed kids. And, you know, it was largely an administrative thing. I was the boss, and I hired the therapists. But from there, I was fascinated by the field and just got into it, and eventually ended up being licensed and rostered by Richard Bandler. It actually was my mentor in neurolinguistic programming, NLP, and got on the Vermont roster of psychotherapists and like that. It's sort of another part of my life from long ago and far away, and I haven't practiced psychotherapy in more than a decade, but yeah, that's there.
Yeah. And also, Tom's written books about ADD, ADHD, yeah, which helped me a lot, which looked at my old ADD self. And Tom's a Michigander as well. Well, let's go on with the story. So it's the late 19th century. Freud sees
1897, 1898, and Freud is abandoning hypnosis for cocaine. And in fact, he wrote a book of poems, love poems to cocaine, which is now back in print, by the way.
Yeah.
And his daughter compiled them, Anna Freud.
Yeah.
And so nobody was ever able to explain why did Freud abandon hypnosis, and it's just kind of one of these enduring mysteries. Well, in doing my research for this book, I wanted to answer that question, and so I went back and I looked at a timeline of what was going on in the 1890s and started looking at newspapers from the era and magazine articles and things like that. And it turns out that a book was published in 1897, which was the largest selling book over a 10-year period. It was like as if John Grisham had a blockbuster novel, and for 10 years it was the world's number one bestseller.
Mm-hmm.
And which is how it worked back in the 19th century. It was like Harriet Beecher Stowe's Uncle Tom's Cabin was a bestseller for 15 years. De Tocqueville's Democracy in America in 1836 was a bestseller for the better part of 30 years. And so, you know, books had persistence. And it's estimated that this book that came out in late 1896 and then broadly started spreading across Europe in 1897 was read by probably pretty much every educated woman in Europe. I mean, it was literally that big. It was bigger than when you calculate it against population, it was bigger than any book that's been published in the United States in the last 20, 30 years. I mean, it's bigger than Harry Potter, you know, big, huge. And it was called Trilby. And most people have never even heard of Trilby, most today. But this novel was just an absolute dynamite blockbuster. And the story of Trilby is the story of this sweet little 16-year-old girl who is a model in an artist studio. And there are these four artists, and one of them is this evil guy. And this was playing on the anti-Semitism of the day. Europe at the time was very anti and openly anti-Semitic. And this guy was Jewish and was portrayed using all the negative Jewish stereotypes. And his name was Svengali. This is where the word comes from in our vocabulary.
You're a regular Svengali.
Svengali,
right.
From it comes from that novel Trilby. I mean, this is a name that was made up by Georges de Murier, who is the author of Trilby. And Svengali hypnotizes this sweet little 16-year-old and under hypnotic trance elicits from her the ability to sing beautiful opera. And so he travels all around Europe. He hypnotizes her. She goes up on stage. She sings these beautiful songs. The people are throwing money at them. And then he takes her back to the apartment and ravishes her sexually. And then in the morning she wakes up from the trance and has no idea what happened. And he's got all this money and a satisfied smirk on his face. And over the course of the novel, she disintegrates rather rapidly until the very end. She dies as she's looking at a picture of him. And then he dies because the hypnotic bond between the two was so strong, and it's just this incredible tragic story. And what happened was that book had such an impact, and then I'm forgetting the guy's name, but the guy who wrote The Three Musketeers, he also came out with three novels in the following 2 years, all of which had men seducing women by hypnosis as the plot device. It was a very, very popular thing.
Alexander Dumas, right. I looked in the index of your book, Walking Your Blues Away, where you mentioned this. So hypnosis gets a really bad name.
That's right. And here's Sigmund Freud, who's Jewish, and 99% of his clients are female, and upper class women, who all had read Trilby, and which is about this Jewish seducer who's using hypnosis. And you can just imagine the first time he puts his hand in front of one of those faces. In fact, in Trilby, de Maurier even describes the technique of putting in, and he says, you know, Svengali put his hand in front of Trilby's face and moved it from side to side and said, watch my hand, and off she goes into trance. And so the first time Freud does this on somebody who's read Trilby, this poor woman is going to go screaming out of his office and never come back. And so he had to do something. He couldn't use hypnosis anymore, and so he turned to cocaine, and then that didn't work. He, you know, a friend his went into cocaine psychosis and died. So he goes to, you know, well, maybe it has to do with penis envy. And he comes up with his Oedipus complex and the Electra complex. And, you know, and then that didn't work. And so he comes up with dream therapy in 1906. And then that didn't work. And so he tries to reinvent talk therapy out of his work with Brouwer in 1912. And that really didn't work. And finally, like I said, he gets cancer and he commits suicide. So his life was not a particularly good one after that. And the technique of moving your eyes back and forth, following the tip of a pen or a couple of fingertips or whatever, is today used and taught by Francine Shapiro and an entire school of psychology and psychotherapy that she's developed called EMDR, eye motion desensitization and reintegration. And it's very powerful stuff. I mean, they're using it at the Veterans Administration for vets with post-traumatic stress disorder. I was in London a couple of years ago with a dear friend of mine who is a psychiatrist he lives in Israel, and he's a psychiatrist with the Israeli Army, or psychologist, rather. And we got a call. In fact, I took the call. We were sitting in my room talking, and his wife called from Jerusalem, and she said, Simcha has to come home immediately. There was a suicide bomb just went off in Tel Aviv, and there's a bunch of dead people, and he's part of the squad that goes in immediately after the suicide bombers and does therapy with the survivors. And the primary therapy that he does is he sits people down and he has them watch two fingers that he moves back and forth in front of their face while they tell their story of what happened, which allows them to process and integrate it very, very rapidly. It's the Israeli variation on EMDR. And so
this is important that besides this theoretical and historical basis of all this, this is utilitarian. This is being used. Walking your blues away, the bilaterality.
There's a whole series of different bilateral techniques. One that Mesmer came up with was stroking the left side of the body and then the right side, you know, the shoulders or the arms. Freud expanded that to other, you know, to the chest, and in which apparently he liked. I don't know.
I'm worried, Tom Hartman, that we're going to walk the time away here.
The bottom line is that if you, you know, when you move from the left side of the body controlling things to the right side of the body controlling things, you have to move through this kind of midbrain part of the brain, which is where emotions are processed. And so doing things left, right, left, right, left, right, while you're holding an emotionally charged thought allows you to process and discharge the emotion associated with it. So the question in my mind at that point was, could it be that walking would do the same thing?
Mm-hmm.
And so back when I wrote this book, it just came out, but I wrote the first draft of it almost 8 years ago, and did the research on it. I used to do a lot of consulting work for psychologists, psychiatrists, psychotherapists in NLP. And so I had a lot of my clients, and at least half of them were calling with personal problems as well as professional ones. So I had them try just taking a walk. Just go for a walk and hold in front of you the picture or the feeling of this negative experience that you want to deal with. And tell me what happens. And what I found is that the average time for a bad memory or a bad experience to process, and I'm talking some really big ones here, we're talking huge stuff, was set around 17 minutes. That it just naturally dissolves.
When you say bring the picture, I mean, imagine that scene in which you loss, or you were humiliated, or you failed, or you were insulted,
you know, you had a horrible car accident, or whatever it may be.
Some big stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Ranging from you know, the death of a parent or a spouse to physical and sexual abuse to just a whole variety of things. Now, it doesn't always work, and as is true of anything, but it does work. Actually, I've not found it not to work. I guess I'm throwing a caveat in there, perhaps just out of caution.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it strikes me that a lot of people might think, wait a minute, I experienced this big loss, this real fear or anger, and I'm going to put a picture in front of it, I'm going to walk, and it's going to go away. Something's been haunting me for 15, 20 years.
That's right. That's right. And I'm telling you, yes, that's how it works. It's really that simple. It really is. And that's the technique where we started this conversation, Peter, you and I, about if you and I and Zog went out and went on a hunting party 10,000 years ago and the saber-toothed tiger ate Zog, how are we going to heal from it? What is the mechanism that we're evolutionarily designed to use that mentally does the equivalent of forming a scab, forming a scar, and then healing the scar? And I would submit to you that it was walking back to the tribe.
Hmm. Well, in Tom Hartman's book, Walking Your Blues Away, there's detailed instructions actually how to do this. In fact, I've often, when I've walked with my wife, I've told her, she'll start bringing something up, and I say, let's not talk about anything negative. Let's just be here right now and enjoy every second of this. And she'll say, but there's a problem. And I'll say, I'm walking. I don't want to think about any problems. So she's a little on to something more than I am.
Well, she's discovered how to use it. I mean, Louise and I will walk and talk about, you know, either problems that we're having or conflict. You know, hey, let's go for a walk and talk about this. Or more often than not, what we do is we walk for creativity. The other thing, there's a chapter in the book about walking for creativity, and there's actual techniques for doing this. You know, if I'm stuck, if I'm writing a book, particularly when I'm writing fiction, if I'm stuck and I just don't know where to go with the thing, I'll just grab Louise and say, let's go for a walk and talk about this. And boom, just stuff, or sometimes I'll just do it alone. And stuff just starts falling into place. It's amazing.
Well, it is. In fact, not only did this hit an emotional chord with me, I rarely ever do more than look at books before I do an interview, and my wife read completely through it, and I read completely through it, and I'll tell you, folks, I tried something with something little, some memory that goes back 25 years, and it actually worked. It worked indeed.
First public endorsement. Thank you, Peter.
Well, we are out of time, and if you can imagine, listeners, that in this interview with Tom Hartman, that we maybe took up maybe 6 or 8 pages of this 100-page book. So it has my recommendation, and it not only does it have history, it also has in a sort of a historical critique. How did we wind up? You know, the whole thing about left brain, right brain. brain? How did we wind up so left brain? And there's some challenging material in here, to say the least. I was hoping we'd get to some of it. I guess you're going to have to go out and buy the book. Tom Hartman is the author. And also, if you have another hour to spend, go to Tom Hartman's website. Tom's first name is T-H-O-M-H and then H-A-R-T-M-A-N-N, although any approximation will get you to it. The book is Walking Your Blues Away, How to Heal the Mind and Create Emotional Well-Being. It's published by Park Street Press. I'll have a link on my website, but you can go to parkstpress.com. Tom Hartman, as usual, thanks for joining me on The Peter Werbe Show.
Thanks so much, Peter. I love talking with you. It was a great conversation.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
It's your big shot at nabbing a 2008 Harley-Davidson XL1200N Sportster Nightster, courtesy of Motor City Harley-Davidson. A two-year lease on a 2008 Dodge Ram 1500 Quad Cab Laramie 4x4, courtesy of Oakland Dodge. A trip for two to Harley-Davidson's 105th anniversary celebration, Labor Day weekend in Milwaukee, courtesy of Miller Lite. And $500 worth of gas to get you there. Compliment to the Rift. Keep it tuned to 101 WRIF to win $50 in free gas, plus a key to these sweet wheels and more. June 14th at Freedom Hill in Sterling Heights. Also, listen for details on Harley Bike Nights around the Motor City, where you can win a key in person.
Think you can handle the rush?
Harley Fest 2008. Presented by Motor City Harley Davidson. Feel the freedom at the number one dealer in Farmington Hills. Also presented by Miller Lite. Miller Lite. Bigger. Bolder. Summer. Oakland Dodge. And your Harley Fest 2008 station. 101 WRIF. Every
we Puzzle Radio. Oh, wouldn't it be grand to gather round and have a listen?
Well, turn something on. I'm starting to think.
A date which will live in infamy.
Good evening, adults. We interrupt this broadcast to bring you a very special presentation.
Boring. Go back to that infamy guy.
Hey, it's 101 WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. Good morning, Motor City. It's Monday morning. It's me, Alan Beck, Slayer. Thanks for sticking around after Peter Werby and Night Call right here on the Riff. If you want to get a hold of me, it's easy. 313-298-WRIF and Slayer at WRIF.com. And you can text now to 71913, keyword WRIF. Make sure you put that first thing in the body of the text and the rest of it. Hey,